Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Why, Angelique? Why would you do such a thing? Your master's house is lost. You've burned the entire city down. Do you know the suffering you've caused? Your mistress, she's out on the street, completely mad. She has nothing left. And yet you won't repent. How many times must I return before you confess?
She's on the street?
Yes, out on the street. And she has sworn that you set the fire. You were in the room last.
It wasn't me.
He's here.
Madame?
Your lover. Prepare yourself.
Now?
Yes.
I can't.
You're frightened, Angelique. I was frightened, too, the first time I lay with Antoine. There's nothing to worry about.
I'm not frightened. It's not right. I won't do it.
You have agreed to this. Why are you saying this now? What has changed?
You want me to sell my body. My soul.
This is not you talking. Who has given you these ideas?
No one.
You're lying. You know what happens when you lie to me.
Claude told me.
Claude! Monsieur Thibault! You have spoken to Monsieur Thibault about this? Are you... You little nigger whore! He's ruined you! Oh, how dare you!
You won't hit your mistress!
You dare hit your mistress! Take her now!
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, July 12th, 2016. So I have been told. Certainly there has been much attention on what transpired in Dallas last week. We talked about that over the weekend. That has continued to be a big deal. I'm sure it will remain a big deal for at minimum the remainder of the month, if not the remainder of the year, with the alleged sniper, not Chris Kyle, but Micah Xavier Johnson. We'll have more to discuss on that as we proceed. However, this program, I would submit, may have some relationship to what transpired allegedly in Dallas, Texas last week in terms of black people fighting back and resisting the system of racism, white supremacy, including the use of counter violence in resistance over many, many centuries, and how that history generally gets concealed, deliberately erased, ignored, minimized. But we'll see if that is an accurate summation as we proceed with the broadcast. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was from filmmaker Michael Jarvis's project, Angelique. She is the main subject that we will be discussing on the program today. This was an enslaved black female in Canada, 18th century. She was convicted, tortured, executed for allegedly setting a fire that burned down a considerable portion of the early city of Montreal in Canada. The conspiracy that she was charged with and convicted was in attempting to escape from her white enslaver. She used this fire to kind of distract people, divert their attention so that she and her white lover could abscond. She was not, unfortunately, able to escape. As I said, she was caught. They convicted her, and you know that's what we're going to talk about during the course of the broadcast for today. I will simply emphasize once again that racism, white supremacy is a global problem. That's the way that we should process it. Frequently, a lot of times we are encouraged to think that racism and the problems that black people face are isolated to one small area, maybe the southern part of the United States, or maybe South Africa, or some small location. And I consistently submit that that is erroneous, that this is a global problem, the global system of racism, white supremacy. Well, I think it's always important to talk to people in different parts of the world to compare, contrast, and see many, many of the same similarities in terms of how white supremacy is practiced worldwide. In that vein, our guest for the program today, we will be discussing her book, The Hanging of Angelique, The Untold Story of Canadian Slavery and the Burning of Old Montreal, recommended by one of our listeners in Canada. We do make an effort to try to nab folks, particularly folks that are outside the U.S., but try to nab folks that people recommend. Our guest, in addition to writing this book, she is the James Robinson Johnston Chair in Black Canadian Studies. Her research interests are in African Canadian studies with an explicit focus on the period of enslavement and emancipation in the 18th and 19th century Canada and the Black Atlantic. She also established the Black Canadian Studies Association, which she currently chairs. The book we're discussing, The Hanging of Angelique, was published in 2006. A real pleasure to have her joining us live on the program from Canada, our guest, Dr. Afua Cooper. Dr. Cooper, are you with us?
I am with you, yes.
Outstanding. So glad you could take some time to speak with us on the program. I'd said a few weeks back when we had Graham Reynolds on the program, we discussed his book, Viola Davis's Canada, which discusses a black female in Canada in the 20th century. In 1940, she refused to move from the white section of a movie theater. She was arrested, and this was kind of a flashpoint in resistance of racism, white supremacy in Canada. He mentions Angelique in his book, and I thought he mentions your book specifically, and I was like, oh man, you all were supposed to be on consecutive days, but it didn't work out that way, but we're so glad we could get you on now. Just anything that you think would be important for our listeners to know about who you are and the work that you do?
I think you have pretty summed it up. I'm also a poet. I'm one of the poets who introduced the dub poetry genre into Canada. Dub poetry is a Caribbean / Jamaican form of poetry. So I'm also a poet, and I do work in Canada, across Canada, in academia and outside of academia, on Canadian history, Black Canadian history, and other issues pertaining to Black people in the country of Canada.
Right on. Were you born in Jamaica?
I was born in Jamaica, yes. I am. Migrated to Canada in 1980. I first came to Toronto, where I lived for 30 years, and then I'm now in Nova Scotia, Halifax, for the past 5 years, teaching at Dalhousie University and establishing a Black Studies program there.
Outstanding. Outstanding. For folks who have not seen like an image or photograph of you, you are a black female, is that correct?
I'm a black female. You can just Google Afua Cooper. there are several pictures, photographs on me, of me online. Yeah.
Right on. This program, I begin just sharing my definition for white supremacy and racism. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that is an accurate definition? Do you think such a system exists?
I think it's an accurate definition. I would also say that black people, we are now at the point where we need to asking people or begging people to acknowledge our pain, to acknowledge the issues that we are confronting and that we know. And we have always done this, so it's nothing new, but must come up with strategies, strategies of empowerment for ourselves and our community, to protect ourselves and our community. The time is over. You know, when people are asking the question, are you sure racist? You know, does racism really exist? Aren't you just making things up? That time is over. And whoever these people are, it's now up to us to, you know, to really come up with the strategies and the methodology for black empowerment. And we are doing it. We are doing it. Acknowledge that we are doing it.
Hear, 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 hear. Try to get right to the book, see if we can cover as much material as possible, and leave time for some questions for our listeners as well. Marie Joseph Angelique, is it accurate to say that she is one of the most, if not the most, well-known enslaved black person in Canadian history?
Well, I think she's the most known black person in Canadian history, but still known, well, not widely known. I still travel across Canada, and many people still don't know who she is. In fact, many people still don't know that slavery existed in Canada. Even people in the black communities don't know that. But in terms of people in the know, they would know that Angelique certainly is that figure, because Angelique was accused of burning down Montreal. Now, how many people is aware of the fact that Montreal was burnt down in 1734, and Angelique, this black woman, this enslaved black woman, was accused of burning down the city, and she was captured, tried, and executed by hanging for that crime. In fact, what the Canadian historiographers and historians for two centuries, what they did was to erase this incident out of history, relegate it to a footnote, because it would mean that acknowledging that, it would mean that you're not only acknowledging a black presence in Canada, a black presence that was premised on slavery. In fact, at that time, most black people were enslaved in what is now Canada. Not only would you be acknowledging that, but you would be acknowledging the awful way in which enslaved Africans were treated in this country of Canada. Because Canada has created a myth about itself. And like all myths, there's some truth to it. But this myth was Canada was the land of freedom, the haven, the refuge for to which Underground Railroad travelers from the United States came and found freedom. Even President Obama, who was here in Canada a few weeks ago and addressed the Canadian Parliament, he also invoked that period of history. It's as if black history started with the Underground Railroad and stopped. And after that, there was nothing. So time and time again, Martin Luther King, when he came to Toronto in the early 1960s, also invoked the Underground Railroad, this land of freedom. And so no one talks about what happened before the Underground Railroad era. What was the condition of black people in this country? They were enslaved. No one wants to talk about that. Or even when the Underground Railroad travelers arrived in this country, what was their condition of life, how were they treated, what were their experiences of black people. And I can't sum it up in one word. Generally, it was awful. It was awful. They endured segregation pretty much, you know, the type that was practiced in the northern states: segregated schools, churches, public facilities. Their land was taken away from them by unscrupulous white settlers, and so on. So the period in the 18th century, 17th century, and for the first three decades of the 19th century of black people in this country, we're looking at enslaved people. And that Canada has brushed under the carpet, as I said in Angelique, you know, have relegated it to the dustbins of history.
Something we've talked about consistently, I think, our Canadian participants, that they have made sure to emphasize that is pretty consistent with regards to how we think about black people in Canada, how we think about racism in Canada, and how we do not think about slavery in Canada, really not even thinking about racism very much in Canada at all until the recent Black Lives Matter Toronto efforts. That being one of the big themes in your book, I think, to make sure that this is brought to the forefront in terms of enslavement of black people in Canada, how important that was, the abuse and torture of black people in Canada, specifically in the Hanging of Angelique, the untold story of Canadian slavery and the burning of Montreal. What other problems were you attempting to address and or solve with this book?
I was attempting to write black history into Canadian history, to say that black people have been in Canada since day one. I mean, the earliest document we have of a black presence is dated, 1604. So it's even before Jamestown for the United States, 1604. So that was one of the issues I wanted to address, our long presence in this country. I also wanted to put the issue of slavery front and center because, you know, I also work on Underground Railroad. I've done a lot of work on Henry Bibb, the Kentucky fugitive slave who eventually ended up in Ontario and established Canada's first black newspaper, The Voice of the Fugitive. So I work in that era too, and it's an important part of our history, but it's not the only part of our history. And when a country, when the spin doctors and historiographers and media people and politicians will snatch that segment of history and beat it to death. That's the only, whenever they think of blackness, they have to go back 170 years to talk about, in their mind, this brilliant period of history and not deal with the before that period or what came after and not deal with what's happening now in these first two decades of the 21st century, then that's troubling. Because what we have in Canada, which politicians are refusing to deal with, I mean, they have denied racism. They have denied that it existed. But there's a specific anti-black racism in this country. One of the things that we're grateful for, Gus, is that the Truth and Reconciliation Tribunal that wrapped up a few months ago with regards to Native Canadians, the Indigenous people. And this Truth and Reconciliation Tribunal went around Canada, interviewed survivors of the residential schools, looked at the reservations, looked at Indigenous life in every aspect as much as possible, and talked about the colonial experience of Indigenous people and how colonialism and the present state has destroyed these people's lives. And the present federal government of Canada said, we will accept every recommendation from this Truth and Reconciliation Tribunal. So that is fantastic. That is fantastic. That has put the issue of racism front and center, you know, on this national agenda. But that's the only issue, it seems, the Canadian state is willing to deal with, the only, you know, group of people, the Indigenous Canadians or Native Canadians. There's a resounding silence when it comes to blackness or to black people. And I'll give you an example. In the spring, Black Lives Matter Toronto camped out on the steps of Toronto Police Headquarters. And they were there for 2 weeks. The mayor didn't meet with them. The police chief did not meet with them. The premier of the province did not meet with these young people. So, it's like you guys don't exist. You're right there. The media is coming down every day and interviewing you. But we, the leaders of this city and province and country, are not going to even talk to you. So there's so much denial of what's happening to black people. And a main issue that this Black Lives Matter Toronto was dealing with and wanted the province to deal with was the shooting of a black man with mental issues. He was an immigrant by the name of Andrew Locou. The police shot him down in front of his apartment, dead. And the shooting of a man by the name of Jermaine Carby at a traffic stop, a routine traffic stop, and Jermaine Carby ended up dead. And so we see time and time again when black people are in interaction with the police, they end up being beaten, they end up being killed. We know, for example, that black children have the highest dropout rate in the cities where they live in Canada. I'll give you another statistic here in Toronto, where I'm calling you from. Blacks only make up, less than 2% of the Canadian population. In Toronto, maybe 17%. Yet black children are overrepresented in care, in child custody. Something like 64% of children in custody are African-Canadian children. And we can go on and on. The arrest statistic, a disproportionate amount of black people, especially black men in prison. We talk about the prison industrial complex. In the past 10 years, the black men in federal institutions have increased by over 50%. That even the commissioner of the prison system has raised an alarm. He's saying that this is like, what's happening here? And there are all these statistics, and yet there's no inquiry from the government. The government is turning a blind eye. The media, what I find interesting, Gus, is that our media here in Canada is focusing a lot on what's happening in the United States, the shooting of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling and the 5 police officers in Dallas. We hear nothing of the 2 officers who were killed in Michigan. Nonetheless, there's a lot of American content. And I said, that's interesting. We need to know what's happening in the world. But very little focus on what's happening here in Canada, here in Toronto, with the whole Black Lives issue, with the marches, with the fact that many of our Black Lives Toronto leaders have gone in hiding because of the death threats they have received and so on. So this country is in denial. The highest percentage of hate crime, and these are not my figures, these are from police services around this country, whether it's in Kingston, Ontario, or Montreal, Quebec, or Halifax, Nova Scotia, or Toronto, Ontario, the highest percentage of hate crime, race-based hate crime, it's consistently committed against blacks or against African Canadians. So it's it just goes on and on and on and on. The high dropout rate, our children are turfed out of school, our children are suspended. The suspension rate is 6 times higher for African Canadian children than for white or other ethnic children. So these are the things we're living with in Canada, and as an educator, as an academic, as a commentator, as an observer, and as a participant in black life, because I'm black, I live these realities too, it is my duty to ensure that this information is got out there through my writing, through my speaking, and through my activism.
Context of white supremacy, again, Dr. Afua Cooper. I think that context and really showing this continuum of denying, concealing anti-black racism, white supremacy, you have just a phenomenal paragraph. This is on page 8 of your book where you write, in my engagement with African-Canadian history, I have come to realize that black history has less to do with black people and more with white pride. If a black history narrative makes whites feel good, it is allowed to surface. If not, It is suppressed or buried. That is why slavery has been erased from the collective consciousness. It is about an ignoble and unsavory past, and because it cast whites in a bad light. They, as chroniclers of the country's past, creators and keepers of its traditions and myths, banished this past to the dustbins of history. The hanging of Angelique seeks to remedy that situation. Brilliantly stated. I wanted to ask, in the book you start like very early on, very first chapter, you start immediately with the torture of Marie-Joseph Angelique. And to just kind of give our listeners a sense of how graphic the detail that you provide. So this is after she's already been captured, convicted, and given the death sentence. And so now they're going to torture her to see if they can get her to confess to being an arsonist. So this is on page 18. You write, Angelique had broken under torture. She had confessed to setting the fires. Her knees and legs were crushed, and she was at the point of passing out. The doctor gave her medicines to revive her, but the judge would not relent. In Angelique's weak and delirious state, he pounced on her again. "Who helped you set the fire?" he shouted. He wanted to hear the name Claude Thibault. Again, Angelique insisted that she had acted alone. Rainbolt signaled Lavelle to continue the torments. The torturer inserted a wedge and smashed it with his hammer on Angelique's knee. Her screams echoed through the halls and rooms of the jail, escaped their confines, and pierced the stillness of the early morning. Why, before you even get into the details of her life and slavery in Canada and everything else that you present in the book, why do you immediately start with the torture of Angelique?
The torture was at the back. It was at the end of the book because I was writing it chronologically. So, you know, you write a person's life. The last chapter or the last paragraph is about when they die. And so initially it was like that. And then I sort of restructured the chapters. I thought opening with the torture would be powerful. I kind of write it as almost like a movie scene, and I thought to myself, if I were to do this as a film, what scene would I put first? And it would be that. So it was from my own imagination and creativity, it was a way of restructuring the chapter. And I also thought, let's just get it right out there. Let's get right down to it, because this is how Angelique entered history. Had she not been accused of burning down the city, had the city not been destroyed, had she not been arrested and tried and executed, we would not know of her. She would pass, you know, into history unknown. She would be anonymous, like the majority of the enslaved Africans who labored in Canada. We don't know their names. They're anonymous, but if you're enslaved and you're accused of a crime, or if you do some quote-unquote heroic deeds like saving your owner from drowning, then somehow your name is recorded and you know, it's there for posterity. So it was a way of just, let's get right to it. This is what happened to black people in this country when they step out of line.
Wow. Also, very early in the book, you give just a comprehensive historical analysis of the development of slavery, coinciding with the origins of Canada, the settlement of this area of the world. In the chapter two, Atlantic Origins, the Slave Woman from Portugal, you put this in context, and I thought this was especially important because I hear frequently where people talk about the enslavement of black people, they will say, well, you know, Africans participated in this too, and you can't just blame white people. In fact, maybe Africans on the continent, maybe they should, you know, bear a sizable portion of the blame because they were participating in this and corralling other black people to ship them off overseas to the New World, as they say. You write on 34 addressing this. The plantation and mine owners developed an insatiable appetite for the labor of enslaved Africans, and so the trade on the African coast increased dramatically. Yet trade implies a commercial relation between equals, and despite the fact that some coastal African rulers were involved, it was not an equal relationship. The great masses of Africans who were turned into slaves on plantations in the Americas and elsewhere were victims, people kidnapped against their will and bought into slavery. On the African coast and its hinterland, as slaving increased and grew permanent, war became the principal method of procuring people for slavery. The colonization and exploitation of New World territories reoriented the slave routes. The mass of enslaved people would no longer go up the ocean to Europe, but across it to the New World. Just your response to folks who say that there should be, you know, sizable blame on Africans and anything bad that happened, hey, they played a sizable role in this.
Well, you know, I would just say that's part of the general anti-black racism, because when you look at groups historically, non-black groups that have been, you know, discriminated against and oppressed and, you know, have all manners of evil carried out against them, people show sympathy. Even with these groups, the leaders, many of the leaders, many of the influential people in this group were collaborators with the oppressors. We know that. I don't have to call any names. You pick any group that you say has been discriminated against throughout history. Many of the collaborators were their own kith and kin. But no one is saying, oh, those people should be held responsible too. Those people should pay reparations. If you and I are in a room or we are from the same country and, you know, the prime minister or the leader of that country sends somebody to kidnap us and sell us off to Mars or wherever, you know, we are going to be sorry for the people who were kidnapped. We're going to be sorry for the victims. And this inability to be sorry, to show sympathy for the victims of the slave trade, who are black people. To me, again, it's just another part of the anti-black racism. And it's a part of white denial. It's a part of the white guilt when white people do not want to take responsibility for what their ancestors have done. And also to acknowledge the benefits that they have received from this system, that they have gained. It's like going inside and you know, reflecting and in an honest reflection. And people are not willing to do that. So they say, oh, the African chiefs were involved. But Africa did not benefit from the slave trade. Europe did, and Africa did. Africans didn't own any of the ships sailing to Jamaica or to Charleston or Providence, Rhode Island, or Boston, Massachusetts. Europeans did. White people did. Africans didn't own any of the plantations. So it's a kind of specious argument.
I'm reminded when we had the author of The Zong on the program earlier this year. This is a white man in Europe, and he wrote about this was one of the white-owned slave ships where they ended up running, allegedly having water shortages on the ship, so they just began dumping enslaved black people overboard to solve their water problem, and they killed upwards of 100 black people, just throwing them overboard because they ran out of water.
Yeah.
So that's what you do. But during the course of the discussion about this incident in his book, and he brought up the same argument that, you know, hey, this couldn't have happened. You know, we had to have black participation in this, that, you know, some of these African chiefs, that they were benefiting from this, too. And I said, well, you have extensive detail in your book about how the city of Liverpool exploded financially. I mean, just the wealth was everywhere and the whole city became built up. And you can see remnants of that today, just the opulence in the city of Liverpool, which was so important to the slave trade. Point me to where the city is on the continent anywhere where, hey, all of the wealth that they got, you can see it to this day because of what they were doing and selling off their brothers. And he said, I'm not aware of any such spot on the continent. I said, that to me makes the point right there. We can continue with the discussion.
Absolutely.
You also, in your book, which I thought was great, you really emphasize the French way of maintaining enslavement of black people. They developed what they called the Code Noir. These are the regulations and policies that they're supposed to put in place in terms of how black people are supposed to be controlled and dominated. And you talk about how religion was an important factor in this. It reminded me a lot of Neely Fuller Jr. He's been on this program many times, an author. He says that racism, white supremacy is the strongest religion on the planet, and that we should think about white supremacy as a religion. You write on page 74, you write, the Detroit River Frontier, which encapsulates the present, which one, wrong page, 75, sorry, page 75, an important clause of the code was that all slaves were to be baptized and instructed in the Catholic faith. As with the case of Oliver Lejeune Louis and Pierre Celestine, many owners followed this instruction and baptized their slaves. Yet this was more symbolic than anything else, since baptism did not mean that slaves would be liberated from their servitude or enjoy social equality with whites. Father Paul Lejeune reported that the young Madagascan boy who received his name rebuked the priest when he baptized him and proclaimed that all who accepted Christianity became of one blood, united in Christ. The priest wrote that the boy said, "You say that by baptism I shall be like you. I am black and you are white. I must have my skin taken off then in order to be like you." The act of baptism did not fool young Oliver. Just in the same vein, the religion of white supremacy, this is on page 162, you write, the ritual of baptism clearly illustrated the power of Frankville, this is the white enslaver of Angelique, as master had over his slave woman. As her owner, he determined how her lineage would be formed and expressed. He decided what his slave's name would be and whether she would have a surname. Whatever lineage Angelique was connected to in Portugal, New England, New York, or Flanders was cut when he renamed her, and that was the intent of the ritual, to detach her from any other time, place, culture, or family she had known. The renaming aspect of baptism symbolized and reinforced Angelique's status as chattel. Frenchville could deal with her thus because as a slave woman, she was natally alienated, that is, without a legitimate heritage as chattel, she was a social non-entity. Really powerful portions, I thought. Can you just speak to that? One, if you think that's accurate, if we should be thinking about white supremacy as a religion and how this was an integral aspect of the Code Noir, the domination of black people?
The Code Noir was the first comprehensive metropolitan legal code that we have in the Americas, 1675, and it came from the French court. And it was really how to regulate black bodies, how to regulate the lives of enslaved Africans, how to make them into slaves, so really to enslave them and to ensure that they would be enslaved forever. And religion, the Catholic faith in this instance, was part of this this process of the permanent enslavement of African people in the Americas, and in our case in Canada. So white supremacy as religion, I would certainly agree with that, because the church, the state, the economic processes, these were part and parcel of this structure that was created to maintain this racial hierarchy, white on top, black at the bottom, that was created during the slavery period. And even during the period of imperialism that, you know, historians call this a period of imperialism after the ending of the slave trade. And you know, that's that's debatable when I say the ending, because there are various and several endings. But I'm talking about the period after, say, 1850 in Africa, coming up to 1884 when we had the Berlin Conference that carved up the continent. You know, historians like to say this is the era of imperialism. But the point I'm trying to get at is that there was this mechanism or this methodology of the three C's: Christianity, commerce, and civilization. This was a mantra of the colonizers and imperialists as they tramped across Africa. You know, so when the soldiers would conquer a polity, who came behind them? The missionaries, Christianity, and the merchants. And sometimes the missionaries would be there first, but the point I'm making is the three C's. And the three C's were part and parcel of the global system, what had become the global system of white supremacy. So the church functioned in this way to enslave black people permanently, not only their bodies, but also their minds. And I think they are successful if, even if our bodies are free, even if the chains are taken off our bodies, but our minds are not, then we are still in serious trouble. Because as Marcus Garvey said, in Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. Because Garvey knew that, and Bob Marley, of course, popularized it in the song, Redemption Song, because he knew if our minds were still enslaved, then liberation is going to be a far way off. I want to add that the religion was a pernicious thing, and I'm not knocking religion as a, you know, as a practice, as religious practice, but how it was used in the institution of slavery, how it was used to suppress black people and to steal their minds. Because when I say that, I'm not knocking religion. Religion, we have the liberation theologies, you know, the liberation theology that was very popular in places like Southern Africa and in Latin America and so forth. But if we even go back earlier on the slave plantations, where we have these preachers, whether they were Baptists or Methodists or what have you, Nat Turner certainly preached a liberation theology. Nat Turner was a preacher, and so was Daddy Sharp of Jamaica, Samuel Sharp in the 1831 so-called Baptist Rebellion that engulfed half of Jamaica, and which eventually led to emancipation in Jamaica. Daddy Sharp was a preacher. Daddy Sharp was a Baptist preacher. So all these men and women used religion for liberation. Harriet Tubman, as you know, was highly, highly spiritual. And she, her church here in Canada, in St. Catharines, in the Niagara area, was a BME church. That was Harriet Tubman's church. And she was religious, and she was also spiritual. So religion, in my opinion, has to be used for liberation of the mind. And if it's used to suppress the mind, then it's pernicious. Then it is an evil.
Outstanding information, definitely, Dr. Afua Cooper. One of the most important themes, I think, in the book, both in terms of, I think you attribute to what might have been some of Angelique's motives for wanting to escape bondage, and why she may have set this fire that burned down a sizable portion of Montreal, 18th century, the sexual abuse of black people during slavery. You write, this is on page 89, kind of goes over to the top portion of 90. You write, slave ads pertaining to women and children often indicate that children were sold with their mothers. Some of these children are described as mulattoes, the fathers of whom are unknown. The relatively large mulatto population at the time of the conquest reveals that white men often sired the children of black women, most of whom were enslaved women. This fact must be placed in the context of the power relationships in slave societies. White men owned black women's bodies and what came out of those bodies. Black women were regularly subjected to sexual assaults by their owners and other white men. If the women were impregnated and had children, these children inherited the status of their mother and were enslaved. It mattered little that the children's fathers were white men, sometimes very prominent white men. What mattered was that their mothers were enslaved and black. One of the most dehumanizing aspects of slavery was the loss of control that black people, especially women, experienced over their bodies. When you talked earlier about the deliberate concealment of black history, that's an integral aspect of anti-black racism. I think this is one of the prominent features right here and has been for centuries. And even in my view, consistently not acknowledging this. And then when they do, there's this push to just say that, well, this was, you know, plantation romance and they loved each other, where this never, ever gets described as rape, as sexual tyranny and abuse. Just can you speak to that?
Sexual tyranny is the right phrase. Angelique, who was the father of Angelique's children? When these children are described as mulattoes or on the baptism certificate, Pierre Inconnu, father unknown. The father is unknown because he's a white man. The father is unknown because he could possibly be the owner of the mother and was more likely a quote-unquote respectable man, an influential man in society. And here he's sleeping with this slave woman, impregnating her, and then, you know, selling out the children. So this is the nastiness, the dirt that's, you know, part of our history, which people in power, i.e. white people, do, whether they're journalists, whether they're historians, whether they're philanthropists, whether they're politicians, whether their school teachers, do not want to deal with, because it would mean acknowledging the great crime that has been committed against black people, against a black body, against a black female body. No one wants to admit that. But we have to acknowledge it, and we have to keep putting it out there. And through our acknowledgement, we confront this nasty and dirty history. And so Angelique was a rebel, because she rebelled against this evil institution that was slavery. And they wanted to dehumanize her. They dehumanized her. They whipped her. She was whipped by her mistress. She was more than likely raped by some white man, her owner. And she rebelled against this. And she would talk. She said, "I hate white people. And, you know, if I ever catch them, you know, in my country, I'm going to roast them." Angelique was born in Portugal. So what I find interesting, she talks about, not that I find it interesting, because it seems to me that her desire to go back to Portugal, because she wanted to go back to Portugal, perhaps stemmed from the fact that in Portugal she could have been a free woman, or she had family there, she had a community, and she said, "If I go back to Portugal and catch any of these French people, I am going to burn them." You know, and then she talks about hating whites. And she would repeat it to people in the town. Angelique also came up from the Hudson Valley. Her first place of enslavement on the North American continent was not Montreal. It was in Orange, which is now called Albany. She was owned by a Dutch American. And so who then later on sold her to a Frenchman in Montreal, but she came from Portugal. So we are talking about these Atlantic trajectories, these Atlantic odysseys. I mean, imagine the violence that's been committed on the body of this woman from day one. And did she set the fire? Did she start the fire in her mistress's house? We know that the fire began in her mistress's house, Madame Francheville. Did she start it? She said she didn't. She, on the torture, she said she did. But the result was that the city was burnt down. And 6 weeks before the fateful fire, Angelique attempted to start a fire in the Cosmos for Mysteries, in the house of the Cosmos for Mysteries. So at the beginning of 1734, she was out. She wanted to make an exit, and she tried burning down the Cosmos house, and the fire was discovered and put out. And 6 weeks later, here we have her associated again with a fire, a huge fire. And so oftentimes, when this book came out, The Hanging of Angelique, and I was interviewed on mainstream radio and television, and some of the hosts would say, slavery wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't like American Georgia slavery or Jamaican slavery. And I'm thinking, Isabel, have you been a slave? What is the definition of slave? What is the definition of slavery? So even when you're saying slavery, it wasn't so bad in Canada, what are you saying? It's like when you read the narrative of Henry Bibb, the Kentucky fugitive slave, and oftentimes when he escaped from slavery and he would tour around and give speeches, and people say, oh, well, you're from Kentucky. Kentucky slavery wasn't so bad. He was a man who lost his wife and child, right, and whose mother lost all her sons because slaveholders sold them away. And so I would often get this, but slavery was mild in Canada. Okay, we admit that there was slavery here. First there's the denial that there's no slavery in Canada, and then they say, okay, we admit, but it was mild. What are you saying when you're saying slavery was mild? Would you, a male journalist, I didn't want to say this to him, I kind of hold my tongue, but I wanted to say, would you want your wife to be raped and abused and bear the seed of, bear not your seed? So if slavery was so mild, these are some of the things that happened in Canadian slavery and slavery everywhere. Mm. And black women were particularly vulnerable.
Wow. You have a brilliant passage in the book talking about this notion of you had some mild form of slavery in Canada. And this trope is very popular worldwide, even in the areas where they will say, oh, man, slavery was really bad here. But over here, it wasn't so bad. You should be, pretty happy if you were enslaved on this planet. We've had a host of whites who've given us that line where you write, again, we have to question the claims of some authors regarding the supposed mildness of Canadian slavery. Describing the Canadian form of enslavement as mild denies the humanity of the enslaved and further compounds their degradation. Kenneth Donovan hits the nail squarely on the head when he writes, slavery perpetuated a culture of oppression. Owners might be cruel or kind, but whatever the treatment accorded them, the shared experience of slaves was usually oppressive and humiliating. How could it not be? I just wanted to ask with the sexual aspect, because that's something that I've been bringing out regularly as well, where in some books, as again I've said, this is a major aspect of the concealment of the abuse and anti-black racism. Sometimes they will point out, yes, the rape of black females, that was rampant, that was a ritual aspect of enslavement in the Northwestern Hemisphere. The American Slave Coast by Ned and Constance Sublett, that's the key theme of their book, that this was mandatory. This is how the population in the United States of enslaved black people grew, was by forced rape of black females. However, it's generally omitted that black males were also sexually exploited as well. One of the few texts that I'm even aware of that talks about this, Thomas Foster, his paper, The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery. And there are a few others, but I think that is equally important because that just doesn't get talked about at all. Have you come across that in any of your research in terms of black males also being sexually abused during slavery?
I just on the point of as breeders or as bucks, B-U-C-K-S, a slave owner would look at this strapping black man and use him as a breeder. But if you're a student of slavery, if you're a student of, the human experience, at some point it's going to come to you that not all slaveholders were heterosexual. You know, and black men and black boys, I am sure, I am certain, were also raped by other white men and you know, or by their slave masters. Because it is part of the territory. We're also talking about a question of power. And I think powerful men who own people's bodies, black people were chattel. They were chattel as cows were chattel, as the chair you're sitting on is a chattel. That was another way of exercising one's power through sexual assaults and through sexual violence. And I have no doubt that black men were sexually assaulted. You know, when we look at today's statistics, for example, in terms of rape and children being sexually abused, and for the longest while the focus was on women, and on young girls, because these are the people who would come forth and talk about this. And now the social workers are telling us that 2 in 5 boys, young boys, are also victims of sexual abuse. And of course, it makes sense. So without a doubt, because the woman or the black woman in this context of slavery was so sexualized, then we know about her situation. We know, for example, heterosexual slave masters like Thomas Thistlewood of Jamaica, who kept a diary on you know, his sexual exploits. And he talks about sleeping with 3, 4, 5 women a day. And he had a diary how many women he bedded for the year, and he kept his diary in Latin. He wrote in Pig Latin, and it's just incredible. But Thomas Thistlewood kept a diary, but he, you know, that makes him kind of unique. He kept a sexual diary. But so were his neighbors on the other plantations who were doing what he did to the black female slaves. And not only did he speak about his sexual, about his rape of these women, but he also talks about the punishment that he meted out to any woman that dared to oppose him. So there were some women on the plantation, or, you know, on neighboring plantations, who refused him, who fought him off. And then he said, what's her name? Phoebe fought me off, and I sent her to the slave driver for 10 or 20 lashes. Or he would, Phoebe fought me off, or whatever, Mary, and I punched her in the face. You know, and his diary is there for people to read. His name is Thomas Thistlewood, Thistlewood. His diary has been translated into English. He was an English planter in Jamaica. But because the woman, the enslaved woman, was sexualized, we know more about her. But, you know, a masculine code forbade many men from speaking out against the sexual abuse they might have encountered. So I'm going to ask you to send me the reference for the article you just spoke about.
Oh, for sure. I will get it to you immediately. Thomas, I'm trying to get him on the program because he's supposed to be doing a whole book on this subject matter. We've referenced it on the program before. There's some other works as well that talk about this, but Thomas Foster's The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery is the title again for listeners. And I checked, if folks are interested, if you would like to get Mr. Thistlewood's diary, Master, Tyranny, and Desire, Thomas Thistlewood and His Slaves in the Anglo-Jamaican World. Wowee. I'm going to get that.
That's the author of that one is, Burrard, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes,
Trevor Bernard, which he thought Trevor Bernard sort of analyzes the diary. But if you want to read the actual diary, it's by Douglas Hall.
Douglas Hall
translated the diary from Pig Latin into English, and you can just read, you know, because Trevor Bernard is sometimes trying to oh, why would Thomas Cecil do this? Whereas if you want to read it, unadulterated inserts, then read, you can read both, but Douglas Hall's The Diary of Thomas Thistlewood or The Journal of Thomas Thistlewood is the one to look at.
Wow. We will be looking to get both of those. Outstanding.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have not dealt with the issue of slavery. We have not dealt with it, certainly in Canada. I think people are beginning to deal with it in the United States and perhaps part of the Caribbean. For much of Latin in South America, we have not dealt with it. A great wrong, a great crime was done to the black collective. And governments, which throughout the Americas, even in black majority countries, I would submit that by and large, these countries are still controlled by white supremacist thought. So even countries like Jamaica and Trinidad and what have you, black majority countries, it's still not like a, you know, a black empowerment thought that's guiding policies or guiding rule and so forth. So throughout the entire Americas, because it's still white supremacy that, as we would say in Jamaica, run things, it's very difficult for this topic of slavery to be dealt with in an honest way. So people will continue to suppress, to hide, to deny, and to slow things off, as you said, oh, that's a plantation romance. And, you know, it's not just that black women were raped and sexually violated, but also we're not only talking about that aspect, but we should also talk about the pedophilia, because some of these men, you know, we're talking about men in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and they're raping little girls. Remember the name of it? It's a well-known book about the slave woman, young woman from Missouri, who was bought by a master. He was in his 50s. Celia was 14 years old, and the very night he bought her and took her to his plantation, he raped her. She eventually killed him and rolled him in the fireplace, and she was hanged. This happened in Missouri. If you think of people, masters like Thomas Jefferson, he began his affair with Sally Hemin, or the violation of her body. She was 13, 14 years old. And these are big, hardback men, as we would say in Jamaica. Hardback, meaning mature, older, elderly men. And they're raping little girls, and boys for that matter. So it's nasty, it's dirty, it stinks. And perhaps that's part of the reason that the powers that be, the people who control academia, media, the law, et cetera, will continue to try to subvert discussions on slavery. But it will not go away. It will not go away.
Absolutely. That also extremely important aspect that we should be making certain to emphasize, that this was child rape, as you said, Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
Child rapist. Pedophile Thomas Jefferson, in addition to everything else, because that's another one, as you exactly as you just stated, that gets passed off as this was some sort of romance, and you know, they really cared about each other, and that just anti-black racism again in action when they use those sort of terms to describe things. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Dr. Afua Cooper, joining us live from Toronto, Canada. In your text, The Hanging of Angelique, this is on page 100, because you also, like I said, it's extensive, comprehensive history of Canada and the racism, how that simultaneously evolved in this area of the world. You talk about black people who were not enslaved, but they were still subject to racism, white supremacy, quote-unquote free black people, and their experience. This is on page 100, where you write, the lives of the black enslaved people and their offspring were regulated and circumscribed by those who owned them and the legal resources they could access. Slavery was as Canadian as it was American or West Indian. It is important to note, though, that in this period of the mid to late 18th century, there were also free black communities in British North America. In Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, black people of loyalist origin built free villages and towns in such places as Preston, Shelburne, Birchtown, and St. John. In fact, these and others became the first free black communities in North America. However, the residents of these communities faced extreme hostility from whites. For example, in 1783, white mobs composed mainly of disbanded soldiers attacked the community of Birchtown, destroying homes, property, and livestock. Other black communities were also penalized one way or another. In 1792, at least 1,200 free black Nova Scotians and New Brunswickers, fed up with the treatment they were receiving in their respective provinces and feeling that there was little hope for the advancement of their race in British North America, decided to migrate to Sierra Leone in search of a better life. This completely obliterates the mythology of we are trekking to Canada, the homeland, the haven for black people, when you have black people that are saying this place is so loathsome and heinous for us as black people that we have got to go someplace to get a better life. Can you speak to this as well?
Well, yes, definitely the loyalist migration of 1792. And these loyalists, as they were called, came from the United States, which was then the 13 colonies. They had fought on the side of the British. They gained their freedom as a result. The British lost the war, the American Revolution, and transported thousands of white and black and native loyalists to British dominions around the world, including Canada. In my neck of the woods in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, we had something like 3,500 free black loyalists who came. The white loyalists brought their slave property with them, by the way. And I must tell your listeners of a book that just came out, by University of Vermont historian Harvey Amani Whitfield. It's called North to Slavery. And what Whitfield did or does in that book is to look at the white loyalists who brought their black slaves and continued the enslavement in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick and Prince Edward Island. But the free black community, those who fought and gained their freedom and were transported to Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, they endured hell because they were living their freedom. And white folks did not like them when they were living their freedom. Because coming, British and American race and social relations dictated that the proper place for black people was a place of bondage and servitude. And here are all these black people running around saying they're free, building churches, schools, preaching, baptizing people, doing all kind of free things, owning their children, so on and so forth. And so we had, and that really upset a lot of whites. And in 1786, there in Shelburne, Nova Scotia, in Birchtown, Nova Scotia, this riot continued for about 2 weeks, and I should say an anti-black riot. Because oftentimes when we say race riot, it disguises really what's going on. These banded soldiers, white soldiers, and their allies attacked these black communities, burnt down their houses, drove them into the swamps, beat them up. And after that, people were like, we're not going to get any freedom here in Canada. We want a place to go. And we Thomas Peters, who had fought in the black pioneers in the South, and attained the rank of sergeant, Thomas Peters, who in his African life was a Yoruba prince and was captured and sold into slavery in Louisiana and then North Carolina, went across the Atlantic to England to speak to the people in authority and said, you guys brought us here. You promised us full freedom and citizenship. But here we are reduced to near slavery. And in fact, some of our brethren have been kidnapped and sold into slavery in the United States and in the West Indies. We want to leave this place. So, and Thomas Peters tramped across Nova Scotia and New Brunswick because they had gotten the offer of going to Sierra Leone in West Africa. And so he tramped across the provinces telling people, there's a place we can go. And in fact, many whites told lies on many of the black loyalists and said, you can't go because you owe me money. And one of the conditions for people to go to Sierra Leone was that they couldn't be indebted. And so whites put obstacles in their way because, of course, when they go off to Africa, who's going to look after their children? Who's going to work the farm? Who's going to, you know, do whatever? But in any event, 1,200 black men, women, and children gathered in Halifax Harbor in December of 1791. And the following January, 1792, they sailed away on 15 ships to the land of their ancestors, Sierra Leone, West Africa. And more people in a place called Big Tracadie and Guysborough, they would have gone to Africa too, but they didn't hear the news. So isolated they were, that they didn't know that this was happening. And that's a critical part of black history in Canada and the history of the Black Atlantic, where these people are returning, are going. Some of them maybe not returning because they were born in the Americas. But a good 50% of them were returning because, according to the documents, at least 50% of them were born in Africa. People like the slave of the first president, George Washington, one of his enslaved men, Harry Washington, escaped from him during the American Revolution, found his way to the British lines, fought for the British, came up to Nova Scotia, and then later on sailed on one of these ships for Sierra Leone, West Africa. So this was a tremendous thing. It showed agency. It showed that the black people thought about their condition, imagined a future for themselves, and would go to the moon, would go to Japan if that was the place of freedom for them. And they went to Sierra Leone. They said, we are out of here. We have done everything possible to prove our worth. What else can we do? And we're leaving. And I that's why I think history is such an important branch of knowledge, because when I look at what's happening today with Black Lives Matters or even how black people are treated, the shooting down of Sterling and so on, and I'm thinking it's because in the white mind we are still seen as chattel. We are, if not chattel, complete chattel, then three-fifths human being. So people in power feel that they still own us and they can shift us around and they can shoot us down and we shouldn't say anything because you're not really a human being. Why are you saying anything? So this reaction to blackness, this reaction to black body is rooted in this experience of slavery for black people and this experience of supremacy for white people. This feeling that they're superior and every other ethnic group of color is below them, especially black people. You know, a Japanese American wrote an article, and I can't remember his name, and he was just looking at race relations in the United States and especially, you know, discrimination against black people. And he says, blackness is the pivot upon which all of this spins. Blackness is the pivot. And W.E.B. Du Bois certainly talked about this too, how the race relations in the United States and the Western world as a whole is pivoted on blackness. So it would seem to me that many other ethnic groups will come, groups of color, and they'll come and they'll experience discrimination, but at some point the gate is open to them. Whereas we who have been fighting for centuries or beating against the barriers, to use a term from the book by historian Blackett, that we beat down the barriers and then other people come and run through. And then we have to start the fight again and again and again. But it's just rooted in this ideology of black subhumanity. Because if we were seen as full humans, then we wouldn't have to be struggling to get for people to listen to us and to say our lives matter. It would be automatic. People say, of course your lives matter. You're human. You're my brother. You're my sister. But when that is so consistently denied time and time again, where does that come from? Where does that idea, where does that thought come from? It comes from slavery. And until Western society can take an honest look, and you know, Gus, we are not waiting for them to take that honest look. We're affirming our humanity. And, you know, Derek Bell, the legal scholar, he passed away recently from Harvard University, the African-American scholar, and he has this short story about African-Americans packing up and leaving America, you know, kind of like the Exodus in the Bible, where the children of Israel packed up and were going off because they were tired of the oppression. What will it take? You know, Martin Luther King said he has seen the promised land. What will it take? This is 50 years after that speech, 50 years or more. And so throughout the Americas, you open the show by talking about defining white supremacy. And it is a global disease. It is a global disease. And black people have been its principal victims.
Absolutely. Context of white supremacy. As we have been on the air, there was a report mailed in. This is a black parks and recreations director was stopped by police for reading a book. This was in New Brunswick, Canada. This was just within the time that we started the program today. Someone sent this to me in terms of a global problem, and this is specifically targeting black people worldwide.
Yes. So here's this man reading a book, and you know, because first of all, black people are not supposed to even read a book.
Absolutely.
So he's actually going against the grain. He's reading a book. Oh my goodness.
Absolutely. And that punishable by death, talk about code noir, that was one of the codes for many, many years.
And that was punishable by death.
Absolutely.
Because you're reading a book or writing, that's it for you, buddy.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have more? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm listening.
I just wanted to ask you, you talking about Angelique and pointing out that her white enslavers, the Frankvilles, the husband died, and you even point that he might have been sexually exploiting Angelique as well, but he dies. And so then Madame Frankville, she's in charge. She is the enslaver of Angelique, and you talk about their relationship and how Angelique fought back between the two. Michael Jarvis even depicts that to some degree on the film that we opened up with, the audio segment that we started with. And you write, this is on page 136, the determined widow continued her husband's practice of lending money to merchants involved in the fur trade and ran her household in Montreal. She even acquired more slaves. By 1741, long after the fire and Angelique's execution, Madame Frenchville owned 7 slaves. Perhaps she had expanded her farm production and needed more labor, or perhaps she needed more hands to handle the pelts brought to Montreal. And this is something also that I think gets obscured, minimized on a regular basis, that the focus, not just during the plantation era of white supremacy, but all the way through today, 2016, white supremacy, the integral role of white women in maintaining this system. Just can you speak with, I guess, within the context of Madame Frenchville and Angelique and overall the role that white women play in maintaining white supremacy?
Well, definitely. Madame Frenchville was a very successful woman. Her husband was successful. They were like a power couple. They came from leading families in Quebec. They were up in from that higher upper echelon of society. They had family members in the clergy, in the military, in the judiciary, in the government. They were powerful people. And when her Angelique said that Mr. Frenchville had promised her her freedom, but he died in November 1733, and And so when he died, she went to her mistress and said, my master promised me my freedom. Of course, Madame said, no way, you're not getting any freedom. I don't know why my husband would promise you your freedom. Whatever the case is, Angelique remained enslaved, and she and her mistress went head to head, because Angelique was determined to gain her freedom. She said it was promised to her, and she ran away even before this fire in April. I said earlier, she ran away in February. She was caught and returned to her mistress. So the white woman, Madame Francheville, kept up her husband's business. Well, I should not say their business. It wasn't just her husband. But she kept the business going. She prospered. She acquired more slaves. Even after the death of Angelique. And she maintained the system. It was a system that, from which she benefited. She was a white woman. They were also operating too in the world of, if you look, say, Montreal's hinterland. It's a world really of Indigenous Canadians, of Native people who would, bring down the furs to be shipped to Europe. It was a fur trading. That was the dominant mercantile activity, fur trading, the beaver pelts going up into the hinterland, even as far as, you know, Wisconsin, getting pelts to bring back to Montreal. So they were very, very wealthy fur traders. They also traded flour and agricultural stuff. So, she wasn't looking at Angelique and said, oh, you, a dear woman, we're women together, or gender or gender unites us. None of that. Angelique was her chattel. Angelique was her slave. Angelique was here to work. So slavery united white men and women together and pitted them, of course, against black people. That's it. And white men and women, it was a system of patriarchy. So men in the social hierarchy, white men were higher than white women. But certainly white women benefited from the system, got rich from it, supported their husbands and their fathers and their sons in maintaining that system of white over black, that system of extracting black labor from black bodies, that system of ownership of black bodies. So that's another thing too, you know, Gus. We don't want to talk about the labor extraction or the wealth extraction. I'm sure you're aware of this recent news release about the Jack Daniels.
Oh,
the Jack Daniels whiskey.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Jack Daniels purchased a slave who was a master brewer, and he was Mr. Green, his name was, and he was the one who caused Jack Daniel's whiskey to blow up, right? And you know, a $1 billion industry. And I'm thinking, okay, so they have released that information. They're telling us that it was a slave man who blew this thing up. Well, are they going to find his descendants, whether direct descendants or lateral descendants, and give them some scholarships and pay off their bills and, you know, build a community centers and the town close by, you know, hype up the town? Are they going to do that? So you're telling me, you know, that an enslaved man, you extract his labor and his gifts and his talents, you know, to blow up your family and blow up your, make you wealthy. Why are you telling me that if you're not prepared now to use some of the wealth to uplift black people? So women and men, remember when men died, when slave master died, their mothers and their daughters and their sons took over. One of my subjects whom I research, Henry Bibb, the African-American slave, his mother had 7 sons. He was the first one. Well, Henry Bibb and his mother was owned by a little girl at Henry Bibb's age, Harriet White, right? And when Harriet grew up and got married and moved from Kentucky to Missouri, she took Henry Bibb's mother's son. She took the rest of the sons with her because she owned them. So when she came into her marriage, when she was married, a huge part of her dowry and her wealth were these enslaved boys.
Wow.
So now you understand why this is a difficult conversation for white people. Difficult. Because it means your system of life will have to be adjusted.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that theft of black labor, black intellectual genius, long running, for centuries continuing evolution of that. I think they've gotten better at it. They even, in my opinion, they make films and celebrate all of the things that they've stolen from black people. I was even reminded of the film Imitation of Life, and they did it was a book, and they did two different versions of the movie, probably have a third version on the way as well. But it's essentially a white woman, role of white women. She starts a business making pancakes, and it's a recipe from a black female, her help, if you will. She takes the recipe from this black female. The black female does all the cooking and slaving and hard labor. The white woman, huge empire, makes all this money, and the black female is still the help, the maid. Just horrible story. But I mean, they make movies rejoicing about this and play this back and have nostalgia. They'll play this on the American Cinema Channel, what have you. But just rejoicing over the theft of black intellectual property, black genius, black labor for centuries that's been going on. And I mean, pirating what's been done on the continent as well. I wanted to get in one quick question before I get some of the folks who dialed in. This is on page 255. Again, where Marie Joseph Angelique, where she has been arrested, convicted for setting this massive fire in April 1734 in Montreal. She is tortured and then ultimately executed. You write, this is again on 255, the court found Angelique guilty of setting fire to her mistress's house and the subsequent burning of the city. The punishment the tribunal named for Angelique, it believed, was commensurate to the crime she committed, being burnt alive, boiled, quartered, the body divided into four parts, dragged behind a running horse, flung upon spikes, poured over with hot oil or tar, or hung in a gibbet. All these were common forms of capital punishment and torture in Europe and European-dominated societies, meted out to the poor and the enslaved. The punishment the justices came up with showed that they felt the offense to be despicable, and the offender and the memory of her should be erased from the land. In Catholicism, being burnt alive meant one's soul did not have a chance to be redeemed and enter paradise. One was condemned perpetually to hell. It was the ultimate punishment. In life, Angelique had been marginalized from society. Likewise, in death, she would be banished from the Garden of Paradise. And I'll stop there. Just this seems to be a long-running trend as well, not just the abuse and oppression, the tyranny that black people faced in life, but ongoing in death to make sure that just in perpetuity, eternally, that you will be abused, neglected, obliterated, not remembered. This seems to be a long
not remembered.
Running. Exactly. Just can you speak to that trend in terms of how racism, white supremacy operates, destroying even the memory of black people?
Yes, not remembered. So just to Angelique, you burn her alive, she's incinerated. She's gone. She won't be remembered. Historians will forget about her. Or if they remember her, they will justify her torture and her annihilation. And it is, like I said, because we were chattel, because we were deemed to be subhuman, that idea, that thought, that belief is still embedded in the mind of, and sometimes it's an unconscious thought, but it's certainly there in the culture. I was reading upon, you know, the shooting of black men by police in the United States last year, 2015, over 100 unarmed, innocent, 100. We hear the name Mike Brown and Eric Garner and so on, but there are many names that we haven't heard, over 100. So this desire, and people who are not shut down are incarcerated. United States has the largest prison population in the world. Incarcerated, locked behind bars. We witness the rise of the prison industrial complex. Prison is now a business. It's a corporation. You can invest in prisons. So slavery has ended, and people cannot legally steal black labor anymore. But they have come up with ways to do that. And if you cannot steal black labor anymore, own black bodies, then what are you going to do with them? If you look in your country after Reconstruction, the return almost to the slavery type status quo, the increase in racial terror, the rise of white supremacist groups. These groups came about to keep black people in place. Again, if we cannot own your body, let's see what we're going to do with you, and it won't be pretty. All this to say that not yet Uhuru. Not yet Uhuru. Our freedom as a black collectivity in these Americas is still tentative and it's still partial. So full emancipation has not come. And if, you know, my good friend, historian Darrell Scott of Howard University, he said, you know, if the civil rights generation, if black generation had head on and was able to erase or to stop police shooting of black men, and they didn't, we didn't, our parents or grandparents didn't, because the fight was so large, then Black Lives Matter today wouldn't have to be dealing with that. And he said that as a way of saying, stop criticizing Black Lives Matter, because every generation has confronted this evil, but has not been successful in fully eradicating it. And it's left up to the next generation to continue. You know, there's a brilliant legal scholar she has passed on. Her name is April Bury. She's African-Canadian. And she uses the story of, what's the name of that Greek mythology guy who rolls up the stone up the hill? Sisyphus. There's this, you know that story.
Yes.
Of Sisyphus rolling the stone up the hill. That's his task. That's a task that the gods gave him. So he rolls the stone up the hill. He reaches the summit, and then guess what? The stone rolls back down. And so he's locked in this task of rolling it up. He knows it's futile. He knows it's going to get to the summit. It's going to roll back down. But he continues to do that work. And she, April Bury, she says, that is African Kenny. That is the kind of like the task that African Canadians are engaged in, and she could say Africans in the entire Americas, this Sisyphus ongoing journey. And then another scholar from my school, Michelle Williams, she uses April Bury's metaphor, and she wrote a paper called Sisyphus's Ongoing Journey, Anti-Black Racism and the Myth of Racial Equality in Canada. And it's published in a book called Multiple Lenses, edited by David Devine. And so I am going to, you know, use that metaphor for all the Americas. We talk about the civil rights generation. We talk about Black Lives generation continuing to roll the stone. Maybe it's a stone of justice up the hill. And we'll rest at the summit for one brief moment. But I believe, I know the time will come when it will rest at the summit, when we will get justice, when we will get justice. And it's an ongoing struggle with justice. I mean, Thurgood Marshall did speak about the law and justice, that maybe the day will come when the law will catch up to justice. You know what I mean? because he recognized as a lawyer himself and later Supreme Court judge that the law in the United States and elsewhere was used to oppress black people. And he said, there's justice and there's a law. And so we are engaged in this struggle for justice wherever we are. And so this Black Lives Matter generation and the rest of us, we are like Sisyphus pushing that stone up the hill. Pushing that stone up the hill.
Wow. Again, is the essay that you cited from Multiple Lenses, edited by David Devine. What was the essay?
The book is called Multiple Lenses, Voice from the Diaspora Located in Canada. The editor of the book is David Devine, as in Devine. And this essay is by Michelle Y. Williams. She's a legal scholar at Dalhousie University, and it's called Sisyphus's Ongoing Journey, Anti-Black Racism and the Myth of Racial Equality in Canada. It's a little article, very short, maybe 6 pages, but brilliant, simply brilliant.
I am going to check that out.
Yes, please. And for your listeners, and I'm glad you had on Mr. Graham on your show, because we need to have a Canadian perspective, because a lot of people in the United States and elsewhere seem not to know what's going on in Canada. There was a man, I think he was from Chicago, maybe you may remember, a couple months ago, I think it was after the shooting of Michael Brown, he came to Vancouver and he said he was seeking refugee status in Canada, an African-American man, because he fears for his life in the United States as a black man. And we were kind of scratching our head and we were saying, brother, we need to educate you. But you see, he was pulling from that 1850s Underground Railroad history. And we're like, we are here dealing with the police for the shooting of black men in the same way. But he didn't, in his mind, Canada was a racial paradise. It was a utopia. And so many Americans, and I would say to people, well, what do you know of Canada? Okay, you know Canada was a colony of France and Britain. What does it mean to be a colony? You tell me every colony that you know about, especially colony with white populations. What's the historical trajectory in terms of, you know, people of color? So Australia, New Zealand, United States, what happened to the Native Americans? So why do you think that these things didn't happen in Canada too? It's a colony, colonized by the same people, their kith and kin as America and Australia and South Africa. Why do you think it would be different here? Have you heard of reservations? Have you heard of the anti-Chinese riots in Vancouver? We had them here too. And so when Americans and African-Americans, I can understand white Americans wanting to run to Canada because, you know, white people basically have it good here. But when African-Americans say that, I have to scratch my head. And here's an article, Gus. It's called, and it's online. It's online. You can get it as a PDF. It's called Civil and Political Wrongs, the Growing Gap Between International Civil and Political Rights and African Canadian Life. And it was, the lead author on this was a lawyer by the name of Anthony Morgan. And it was put out by the African Canadian Legal Clinic. And Anthony Morgan presented this document to the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations, Civil and Political Wrongs, the Growing Gap Between International Civil and Political Rights and African Canadian Life. And this was presented to the United Nations. And basically, it's a document which looks at anti-black racism in Canada in terms of education, poverty levels, the criminal justice system, arrest statistics, and so on. And it's free, it's online, so I would urge your listeners to download this and just read that document. It will give people an idea of what we in Canada are grappling with. and how the law has failed African Canadians. And so I applaud the young people of Black Lives Matter, it's Toronto and elsewhere in this country, because they have put themselves at the forefront of the struggle, and they are feeling the backlash. Boy, are they feeling the backlash. They have received death threats from white supremacist groups. Many of the young leaders have gone in hiding because, you know, no one can ensure their security. The media has come out against them. The police is against them. Important people in society, you know, likewise are against them. Simply because they have stood up, they have marched, they have called for police accountability, they have spoken up on this vicious kind of discrimination against Black people in this country. So it is a lot, and we are at the cusp of something big. We are at the cusp of something great, and I think it's something positive. And I think, you know, as Marcus Garvey said, it's about taking the chains off our minds.
Context of white supremacy. Just shared the report that Dr. Cooper just referenced. You can check it out. Online, you can download the whole thing for free. It's a PDF, as she stated, Civil and Political Wrongs, the Growing Gap Between International Civil and Political Rights and African Canadian Life. Put it on the Facebook page. You can download it at your leisure. We will nab some of the folks who dialed in who have questions. One of our callers in Canada is with us. Did you have any questions for Dr. Cooper? You should be with us, our caller in Canada.
Hello, guest. Hello, Dr. Cooper. Pleasure listening to you, hearing you. It was amazing. I love how you covered all the angles about Canadian-style white supremacy. And I have three questions for Dr. Cooper. The first question is, why do you think Canada is willing to talk about Indigenous issues but stay silent about its anti-Blackness?
One of the reasons for that is that, what did you say your name was?
Oh, I'm the caller in Canada.
Okay. One of the reasons for that is the Indigenous people have been here. They're the original peoples of these continents. They're the original people of Canada. You really can't... I mean, of course, there was this idea once upon a time to wish them away, whether it's through genocide or what have you, or residential schools. But the Indigenous people have empowered themselves, and they have become a strong voice. And, you know, the whole residential school situation has really rocked this country, as report after report came out about what happened to First Nations kids in these schools. And it was out of these reports about the residential school that finally the Truth and Reconciliation Tribunal was launched. So you really, you have to recognize that these were the continent's first people, that they have a right to this land that you have been stealing from them for 400 or 500 years. So I think that's part of the reason. Another reason is that Indigenous people themselves have really organized themselves. We have the Assembly of First Nations, the assemblies of chiefs across the country. They have a kind of central directorate. They are band leaders. And from the white society, there are enough people in white society who are sympathetic to the cause, who are allies, who have been documenting the atrocities against Indigenous people. And that also, you have enough sympathetic people at the governmental level. So our new government, it's still fairly new. The new Liberal government headed by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is a government that said, hey, look, we're going to implement all these recommendations. Indigenous issues must be addressed. We have all these kids committing suicide on the reservation, etc., etc. Tremendous wave of sympathy for Indigenous peoples, but also remember, Indigenous peoples themselves took the initiative And it's been decades of organizing Indigenous women across Canada, took Canada to the World's Court at The Hague and at the United Nations because of discrimination against Indigenous women when they marry non-Indigenous men. We've had the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. That's still an ongoing thing. Hundreds of Indigenous women have been murdered or missing. And finally, we will have a commission to examine what's going on. So that's one of the reasons. With Black people, I think the desire to continue, or the denial, not even the desire to, but the denial of Black pain, I would say is rooted in one of the ideologies of slavery, this ideology of Black subhumanity. Because, you know, if you look at the writings of influential intellectuals, like Thomas Jefferson, for example, he thought that the Native American, that they were savage, yes, but he thought they were beautiful, they have lighter skin, they had long straight hair. He admired that. He thought with over time, if you overwhelm them with, you know, white people coming and taking away the land and just overwhelm them in generally, they would assimilate, they would disappear, they would merge into the white population. He did not feel that way about Black people. And putting it directly into the Canadian context, Canadian politicians and officials of the last century meaning the 20th century and the one before that, the 19th century, so these last two centuries, felt that Blacks were what they call unassimilable. And that's part of the reason that they passed this act in the Canadian Parliament in 1911 to ban Black migration. They said Africans, wherever they are not welcome in Canada because they're unassimilable. They're here, their skin, they can't fit into the Canadian nation. So, of course, we know many Blacks still came and, you know, Black people are saying, hey, we are assimilable, we are Christians, we speak English, right? But there's this ideology of Black subhumanity. I think it is the basis of this anti-racism and the denial of Black pain, because how can you feel pain if you're not human? And Charles Mills, if you want to examine this in depth, there's an African Canadian American, he's now teaching in the States, by the name of Charles Mills, M-I-L-L-S. He wrote a book called The Racial Contract, two books that I'm going to reference here, The Racial Contract and Blackness Visible. And he's a philosopher, so he examines this ideology of Black subhumanity and how it's still a current discourse in our time. But I think that's part of the reason Canada is not immune from it. So we have the massive incarceration of African Canadian men in this country at the provincial level and at the federal level, and everyone is mum. It's just people like us, intellectuals and policy lawyers like Anthony Morgan and Michelle Williams, who are talking about these things, and the young people on the streets. You would think that conscientious politicians and leaders in society would say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? Why are so many Black kids in the child welfare system? Why does Toronto have a 60% dropout rate of African-Canadian children? Hey, wait a minute. So it's not as if no one is talking about it or saying, we are. We, members of the Black community, are. But the people who maintain power, who hold power, are turning a blind eye. And I don't want Black people in Canada. You know, when Black Lives Matter, last Sunday when you had the Gay Pride March and Black Lives Matter stopped the march for half hour, and you had Black people saying, oh, they shouldn't be doing that, they're being disruptive. I don't want these, honestly, I don't want these people to say anything, because if you cannot come up with a solution, when these young people are talking about Black pain and pointing to specific example, where are you? Where are you? All you're there is criticizing them. So if you're not part of the solution, then you're part of the problem. So I hope I answer your question. And I think it's rooted in lots of humanity. We are indigenous people. We did have intellectuals, ideologues who said, oh, the native is a savage and a brute and all of that. But by and large, they were seen as people who could be assimilated into white society in a way that black people couldn't. There's another reason, I think, too. I think there's a hello?
Oh, we can hear you.
I think there's a kind of, I don't know if it's a Canadian thing or a white thing or a human thing or a people thing, but some people can't seem to be able to deal with one issue more than once. And we always said, well, no, the Canadian state is dealing with the Truth and Reconciliation Tribunal. They're not going to look at any other thing, not climate change, not anti-black racism. This one thing is going to occupy them. But the state can do what it wants to do, you know, but the black community has to do what it needs to do. And I must say to the caller that the province of Ontario, because Canada has 10 provinces and 3 territories, but it's a kind we are a federal system at the same time. But the province of Ontario launches a public community meeting on anti-racism. The province of Ontario has instituted an anti-racism directorate to hear from people across the province. In the 90s, there was an anti-racist secretariat. Then the conservative provincial government came to power and abolished that secretariat. This new liberal provincial government has reestablished an anti-racism secretariat or directorate. So they want to hear from people. There's going to be a public meeting, I think, this Thursday. Yeah, this Thursday. Maybe at Rice University. I don't remember. You can Google it and find out. But in fact, they're going all across the province to talk to groups about this new directorate. I want African people to go in and speak specifically to anti-black racism. Because, you know, all so-called visible minority groups in Canada do not experience racism the same way. As I said, our police department has told us that the majority of race-based hate crimes are committed against black people in this province. So, that's a positive note. The province of Ontario has decided to establish an anti-racism directorate, and I wish them well, but it can only be effective if people go and make their voices heard and be a part of the process. It can't be a band-aid and it can't be, you know, a token to shut people up. Oh, yes, here's the Thursday, January 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Daniel's Spectrum, which is a theater at 585 Dundas Street East, Toronto. So go out, people, and speak to the province and Michael Kotu, who is a black man and who is a minister of government. Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Okay, wow. I love your answer. So now on to my next question, but thank you. Thank you for that very thorough answer. Do you think...
You're welcome.
I want to ask, because one of the things I always say to Gus is that I find black people here, not just black Americans, I think Canada is good, but black people here, like a lot of my family members, do not want to look at Canada critically, even when I'm showing them evidence or other black people. It's very hard, like such as what happened with the Afrocentric school. You have black people upset that, you know, a black child isn't holding hands with a white child and all this silliness. So I want to know, is there an actual history in Canada of black scholars that critiqued multiculturalism and integration, sort of like how you had Steve Biko in South Africa, Malcolm X, and Garvey in the U.S., even though Garvey's Jamaican, but, you know, she was very influential in the U.S. So that was there that kind of discourse in Canada? Have you ever been across that?
There is that discourse. There's a critical mass of African-Canadian scholars, of white scholars, of scholars from all kinds of ethnic backgrounds who are working in the field, critiquing multiculturalism, critiquing racism. Yes, of course, we hold that tradition. And you can count Garvey as a Canadian, too. Because when Marcus Garvey was expelled from the United States, guess where he held his major convention? In Canada. There were 11 conventions in Toronto. He had at least two in the province of Nova Scotia. So Marcus Garvey and the UNIA has contributed tremendously to African-Canadian political and social thought. But you have scholars like myself, Himani Banerjee. She's of South Asian descent, and she's a scholar of multiculturalism. You have Ronaldo Walcott, who does critical race theory, cultural studies, Handel Wright, Dolana Magadimo. Just type in Google African-Canadian scholars who work on these issues. Michelle Williams, earlier on in the program, I spoke of legal scholar Michelle Williams from Dalhousie University. There's Isaac Saini from Dalhousie University. Tamari Kitosa, who's a criminologist at Brock University. A whole bunch of people. We do have a critical mass of people who are working in these fields, whether they're sociologists or historians. And let me go back to the anti-racist directorate that is just now established in the province of Ontario. That came out of black struggles, you know. That came out of black people's struggle in holding, seeking to hold the government accountable. So it's not just a gift from the province or from Premier Catherine Wynne, who said, oh, we're going to set up this directorate. It's because of struggle that black people and allies have engaged in over the decades. You have people like Professor Kwa Benjamin from Ryerson University, who has been a leader in this field and who was instrumental in getting the first anti-racism directorate established under the new democratic government of the 1990s. So, you know, we applaud the government of Ontario, but we know this came out of struggle. This came out of struggle. This came out of people dying. You said many of your family members don't want to look at racism, especially pertains to black people. That is a problem. That's an issue in the black community. Many people, I don't know, many black people have internalized racism. They feel embarrassed. They feel that you're one of my daughter's friends, who is a second-year university student, and one of her good friends, a male friend, was beaten up by police in Kingston, Ontario. And she said, all the time I thought black people just like to talk and make a lot of noise and they would just hold their heads down and go to school like I was going to school. I thought it would be okay. And she said, until my friend, who was a decent law-abiding student, was beaten up by the police in Kingston, Ontario. And that was the moment of truth for her. All the time she felt, you know, embarrassed. She didn't, why are these people protesting? And then her friend got beaten up. And so there's also that internalized racism. We have been taught that our pain, our struggle they're not worthy. Why are these people, why are these kids running up and down the street marching? Why are they always complaining? But we have opened the doors for so many people. The employment equity, a still affirmative action of the 80s and 90s that black people struggled for, black people have not been the main beneficiaries. White women in Canada have been the main beneficiaries of employment equity. Black people, men and women, struggled for it. So I would say to your family, you know, usually it's when people have some kind of negative experience with the state or with a state institution that they suddenly find their blackness. So it's unfortunate. I don't know if the college gave you.
Oh, I'm still there. Oh, I loved every second of that answer. And I'll definitely keep that in mind, and thank you for pointing that out to me. I'll definitely try to look into that. So now, my final question. My final question, in your view, just your view, what would it take for a black revolution to happen in Canada?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by a black revolution. I mean, a revolution is, you know, a
community. I guess sort of the end of anti-blackness, at least in the Canadian context.
Yeah, in the Canadian context. You know, if all of us employ whatever strategies and said enough, no more, or even a critical mass of us, that black revolution will happen. Emancipate ourselves from mental slavery. It is the mind. It is the mind. And when we get those chains off our minds, and when we think that we are worthy people, that we are people of worth, if we do not think we're people of worth, it won't happen. We will continue to take what, you know, things happen to you and you just say, oh, those are just ignorant people. And you walk away and it happens to you day after day after day after day after day. That's an issue with self-esteem when you allow it to happen. But if we think we're people of worth and we're worthy and you know, we have the right to be here. And one day, 2 days, we take her. I'm thinking, we have a 60% high school dropout rate. Why do we continue to send our children to those schools? If parents said, for 1 week, for 1 month, I'm not sending my child to that school, then we're going to think, oh, but if I don't go to work for a month, I won't have a job, I won't pay my rent or feed my kids. That's true. But, you know, we have done this before. When they had the Montgomery bus boycott, it was planned out. People walked, people rode bicycles, people carpooled, people took whatever was necessary, people did it. And we have to come to that point where we say, no more. For 50 years or 100 years, you've been doing this to our children. No more. I'm pulling my kid out of this school. Okay, what am I going to do to educate my kids? Let's start talking about this. Let's start talking about this. You know, what people have done in Baton Rouge, they have stopped. We're told that the last weekend the malls had to close early because black people simply refused to go. When you hit an oppressive system in its pocket, because capitalism, the only thing it cares about is money and profit. And when you stop feeding it, it will turn, you'll get the attention that you need. So it has to be multi-pronged. Protests in the street, yes, that's absolutely indispensable. It is a tool of the voiceless. And there are other things. There are other methods.
Huh. I don't appreciate that.
But we have to make the decision that the time is now. The time is now. And it will. I mean, half of racism, I think, is psychological, meaning that it's up to us to say no more, no more. We have to have the kind of mentality that people like Marcus Garvey had and Malcolm X had and Dr. King and Harriet Tubman. You know, when J. Edgar Hoover went to Dr. King and said, you know, I got all this dirt on you, and you better stop leading the struggle, and you better commit suicide, because if you don't, I'm going to expose you, I'm going to print it in the newspaper and put it on radio and TV. Those are powerful threats. And the weaker among us would say to J. Edgar Hoover, okay, sir, you know, I'll just stop, or I'll just won't be as strong as I was. But Dr. King, he said to J. Edgar Hoover, I fear no man but God. Now, if somebody says that to you, what are you going to do to that person? Dr. King said, release the tapes. He, you know, he was a religious man, so he's going to use the religious language. He said, release the tapes. I fear no man but God. Because he was, by this time, totally free. He was totally liberated. He had taken off the chains, the mental chains. He had cast them away. So here this man coming, threatening his livelihood, his family. And he said, the ultimate judge is God. I'm not going to turn back the struggle. I'm not going to commit suicide. What could they do with Dr. King at that point? I think when all of us reach that level of consciousness, then this oppression will be over. And of course, it's going to have its consequences. We know that. But it will be over. The disrespect of black people is just incredible. And once we have the self-respect and said no more, enough is enough, then this thing will die. You know, the mainstream society, they have sanitized Dr. King. All you hear about is I Have a Dream speech. But Dr. Martin Luther King was one of the most revolutionary and conscious person to walk the face of the earth. Of course he evolved. Of course when he started at the age of 26, he wasn't, you know, he died at the age of 39. Of course. But by the time he was assassinated, you have one of the most conscious and enlightened human beings on the planet. Very, very radical person. And a lot of people don't know that. Because he had become fearless. So, maybe to answer your question, the Black Revolution will happen when we lose our fear.
Appreciate that. Our caller in Canada, I was reminded when you were answering his questions, Charles Mills has been a guest on the program. We discussed...
Oh, Charles Mills. Oh, really?
Yes, ma'am.
Very good.
We just reviewed the racial contract and Ronaldo Walcott. He's been a guest on the program as well. We have done our time with folks in Canada. Caller in New York, Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Cooper? You should be with us. Thomas in New York.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good evening, Gus. Good evening, Dr. Cooper.
Good evening.
Wow. A black revolution in Canada. I just wanted to know, I'm a little skeptical about, you know, the Canadian Black Lives Matter movement. I just don't really see the significance of it or having any movement in Canada. How many Canadians, black people in Canada, are, would you say, are like Canadians? Like they could trace back their history to that slavery point in Canada time, or would you say the majority of black people in Canada came after that?
Well, the black community's plural in Canada is came from diverse backgrounds. You have the what we call indigenous black Canadians. These would be people like Marie-Joseph Angelique. These are people who trace their roots back to the migrations of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And it's from all over the country, British Columbia to Vancouver to Alberta to Ontario, wherever. And then in the late 19th century, and especially after the Second World War, you had migrations from the Caribbean and from Africa. So diverse streams of people. We've had a very active civil rights history, civil rights movement. One of the courses I teach is called the Civil Rights Movement in North America, and I look at both countries. Gus here spoke about bringing Mr. Graham Reynolds, who wrote a book on Viola Desmond. Viola Desmond was an African Nova Scotian 1946 was ousted from a cinema in New Glasgow, Nova Scotia, because she sat in the white area. She was a black woman. She was literally thrown out of the cinema and jailed for sitting in the white area. That was 1946. That was 9 years before the Rosa Parks incident on the bus. And, you know, the Viola Desmond affair led to the formations of civil rights groups in Nova Scotia and across Canada that took cases to the Supreme Court and so on and so forth. So we've had an active civil rights movement, the Sir George William Affair University in Montreal in 1969 when the computer room of that particular university was set on fire. And hundreds of students, black and white and so on, were arrested and jailed and beaten up. So in Canada, it's a very huge country. Canada is continental in scope. Three oceans, the Arctic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. It's the United States' largest trading partner, the longest undefended border in the world between Canada and the United States. It's a big country. The population is small when you compare it to, say, the United States. There are 30 million people in Canada. There are 300 million people in the United States. There are about 1 million people in Canada. So the 1 million black people. So the Canadian black population, in terms of, say, it's similar to the African American population, which is what, 40 million in a population of 300,000. Canada, 30 million. African-Canadian population, about 1 million. So people say, oh, the black population in Canada is small. Well, the white population is small, too. You know, in terms of the G20 countries, Canada has a small population, which I think makes it critical. That's one of the reasons that we should have full rights in Canada, equal rights, because it's a population country in a huge country with a lot of resources. It's probably the richest country on the planet in terms of natural resources. So the fact that we have poverty in black communities and in indigenous communities and, bad education for a certain population makes it just wrong and just sad. Because it's a very, very wealthy country. But, of course, the resources are not used for the majority of people. So I'm not sure what your question is. It's are there a few black people in Canada? What's their relationship to Canada? What I must say to you, sir, is that the black population in Canada began before the black population in the United States. The black history in Canada is a longer history than that of the United States.
I don't know. My question was, I guess, I'll just leave it at this, but of the 1 million black people in Canada, of that 1 million people, how many of those 1 million black 1 million people would you say are, I think you called them indigenous black people? And how many of that 1 million, what percentage of that 1 million people are people who came from other parts of the African diaspora into Canada? And I'll mute my line.
Right. But what's the basis of your question, though? Because if I'm an indigenous,
that was my question.
Let's say, what is the point of the question? Because I'm not myself a quote-unquote indigenous black Canadian. I was born in Jamaica. I came to Canada 35 years ago. But my experience with the system is pretty much the same as if I were a quote-unquote indigenous. So I'm not sure what the purpose is of the question.
I just wanted to know how many of the people, black people that live in Canada, to trace their roots back to a point in time where they didn't come from somewhere else. Like, they can't tell you where they originally came from. That's what I wanted to know. And you said it was 1 million black people there. So what percentage came from into Canada?
I would say it's hard to say now because I myself came from Jamaica, right? My children were born in Canada. One of my children, Noah, has two children. So I have two generations of my own lineage that was born in this country. Ultimately, all of us, we trace our lineage back to Africa, just like African-Americans. So I cannot really, I don't, what is the point of the question? Because,
black people in Brazil.
I
was just trying to give you the point. Me as a black American, if I trace my roots back, I'm only going to come back to America.
You're gonna go back to Africa.
I get that point, but what I'm saying is what I can prove, like my family, like I can look up this person, that person, is all gonna be, they're gonna come from North Carolina, then originally they moved up to Virginia or a certain point. That's as far back as I'm gonna be able to go as a indigenous, I guess you could say, American. So what I was saying is, there's people that come to America from other countries, like Haiti, Jamaica. They're also black people, They get treated just like, everyone else, but they're not, they could go back home. They could say, okay, I'm going to Trinidad for a couple of weeks, to see my family. Like, how many of the black people that's in Canada they can't say they can go anywhere. They just always in Canada.
Well, I would tell you, many, many, many hundreds of thousands of the black people in Canada cannot go anywhere but Canada. And if they seek to go anywhere else, it's going to be Africa. Because I have two generations of descendants who are born in Canada, and I tell you, they may not be going to Jamaica or Trinidad or wherever, or Somalia or wherever, because they have been here. In terms of my own personal lineage, I have colleagues and friends who have their lineage goes back all the way to 1740, 1604, into Canada. And if it's not Canada, then it's perhaps the United States, like the planter slaves who came up from New England in the 1760s. African Americans who came up from New England to Nova Scotia, or the Black Loyalists who came from South Carolina or wherever. So, 200 years, 300 years of living in Canada. But I do not see the point of trying to determine there are black people in Canada who, because at the end of the day, my dear sir, our interaction with the state is more or less the same. When a police officer confronts you, he's not going to be asking you, well, young man, how many generations of your family lived in Canada? He's not going to ask you that. He's going to see a black face in front of him. Or when the teacher in grade 7 looks at you, you're going to speak with a Canadian accent. She doesn't care that you say you're seventh generation Canadian. She just sees a young black child in front of her, who she thinks is an inferior person and must be put in special education. So the system doesn't really care about how many generations you are in this country.
Thank you for my question.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Let's see. The caller at 9401. Did you have a question for Dr. Cooper? Caller at 9401. Did you have a question for Dr. Cooper, or are you just listening? Oh, looks like they might have dropped. Moving right along. Roz, did you have a question for Dr. Cooper? Roz, did you have a question?
Yes, greetings to you, Gus. Good evening and greetings to you, Dr. Cooper.
Good evening.
It's actually really great to hear what you have to say this evening. And I did have about
thank
three
you.
Questions. Oh, thank you, too. And I had three questions. The first one is kind of like, I guess, a two-part question. I just wanted to ask if at earlier in the program, because I missed like the first hour, but early in the program, was Angelique in a relationship with a white male?
Say this again, Angelique what? I didn't quite get it.
I'm sorry, I wanted to know, was she in a relationship with a white male at the time that she burned down Montreal?
Yes, Angelique, there was a Frenchman by the name of Claude Thibault, if you read the book, you'll see it. And he also worked for Angelique's, owner, Madame Francheville. He was what the French called an engagé, meaning he was a kind of indentured laborer. He was not a slave. He had a contract for 36 months, came from France to Canada and to work as a laborer. So he and Angelique had teamed up, but Claude Thibault was not the father of her children. Claude Thibault came in the picture after she had her children and they had died. She and Claude Thibault tried escaping together. What I find interesting is that Angelique was caught and tried and executed, and Claude Thibault disappeared. And part of the reason that Claude Thibault could escape was because he was a white man. And it was easier for him to escape and run away and not be questioned than it would have been for obvious black female, black enslaved. So yes, she was involved in a relationship with Claude Thibault.
Okay, because the reason I asked was I wanted to know if you would say that she would have been suffering from Stockholm Syndrome due to the fact that she was under such severe abuse by white people and mistreatment, yet she chose to actually be with someone who was of the group that was oppressing her.
No, I don't think she was suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. I think Angelique was quite strategic, because think of it. If you are a visible person, when I say visible, I mean you can't pass for white. People will see you and see a black woman. In the town, in the woods, they're going to know you're a runaway. If you're with a white person, especially a white male, he could say he's your owner. Remember William and Ellen Craft when they escaped from Macon, Georgia to Boston? They used that rose. They used that guise. Ellen Craft, who was very light-skinned, dressed up as a man and pretending to be the owner of William Craft, who was her husband slash boyfriend, right? So my reading of Angelique and Claude Thibault is that she wanted to escape and Claude Thibault was going to be her ticket, because Claude Thibault was also a soldier. He was a former soldier. And so he knew the Canadian landscape. He knew the Montreal landscape. And as a white male, it was easier for him to be up and about, to exercise freedom, than it was for Angelique. And in fact, in February, when she wanted to run away, and Claude Thibault had taken on a job as a laborer with some person in town, she cursed him. She said, "Why did you take that job? You know we had planned to run away, to escape. Why did you go and take another job?" Because she knew that by herself she couldn't make it, because she would draw so much attention to herself. But with a person of the white race, especially a man, she stood a better chance. And so it was interesting, during the second escape attempt, Angelique was caught, Claude Thibault was not. He was able to escape. They were also looking for him too. He would have been executed had he been caught, because they were also suspicious that it was not just Angelique who set the fire, but that the white man was one of the arsonists. So had he been caught, he would have been hanged also. But he was able to make his way out, and he's disappeared ever since. I think they're still looking for him.
Wow, thank you. I can't wait to read your book. I just got it, and now I understand that she was being codified, which is wonderful. Very brilliant approach to attempting to make her escape. My other question was, because you come from a country, Jamaica, which is majority black and ruled by white people, and you've now moved to Canada where black people are not necessarily the majority, but it's also ruled by white people. What would you say is the difference between racism, the way it is expressed and experienced in Jamaica versus the way you have experienced it in Canada?
That's a good question, because you see, Jamaica is a former colony in the way Canada was a former colony, or is a former colony. Jamaica was a slave society from the time of slavery to present, had a black majority, but still ruled by people who, you know, used a colonial philosophy, people who believed in white supremacy and black inferiority. But growing up in a black majority environment, whether it was in the rural area where I lived for a while or in Kingston where I also lived, it meant that you saw yourself reflected in everything, in any job. The bus driver was black. The school teacher was black. And the school teacher felt that you as a student, as a young black working class student, could also achieve and be anything. So growing up as a working class kid in Jamaica, I didn't feel there were limitations on me in terms of, say, career aspirations. Myself and my classmates, we felt that we could do anything, whether it was nuclear science, to be a nuclear scientist or a doctor or a lawyer or a university professor or anything, a dressmaker. So that's a big difference. Now, when you come to a place like Canada, where in white society there's a belief that black people are inferior, and that belief is put in practice in the classroom. So you have kids who come from families, say Caribbean families, where everybody is achieving. They come from that society where, you know, they do not have a lid on their minds. The children of these people go into a classroom in wherever in Canada and are told that, oh, why don't you, you know, basically told what Malcolm X was told when he said he wanted to be a lawyer. And so the low self-esteem kicks in. People don't feel, the kids don't feel they're competent, that they have what it takes. The bar is, you know, the teachers do not believe in their abilities. In fact, the teachers do not believe they have abilities. So that's a huge difference. I'm always surprised, you know, when I was a young woman coming up in Canada, and white people would say to me, oh, you're so confident. And it would puzzle me, because I couldn't figure out what they were saying until I realized what they were saying. Because as a black young person, I'm not supposed to exude confidence, you know. I'm not supposed to have these ambitions. But fortunately for me, I experienced my coming of age in Jamaica. And so when I got to Canada, it wasn't, you know, going to university, doing a PhD. In my mind, that wasn't a big thing. Oh, you know, you had to work hard. You had to work hard and everything. But I never doubted my abilities. But black kids here have to go through that, the doubting of their abilities. And so that's a main difference in growing up in a black majority society as opposed to a black minority or a white majority society. Because white majority societies, the thought about black bodies and about black people are not good thoughts.
Thank you so much for your answer. And my final question is, are you familiar with the works of Neely Fuller Jr., Dr. Francis Press Welsing, and Dr. Marimba Ani?
And yes, I'm familiar with both works. In fact, we have both the names you mentioned, those scholars and authors have been here in Toronto, I should say, and have given lectures, yes.
Thank you so much for answering my questions, and thank you, Gus, for taking my call.
You're most welcome. Have a good evening.
For sure. We had a couple more folks that dialed in. See if we can get their questions.
Oh, I can only take one more question, Gus.
Oh, okay.
I have to call it a night because my family is waiting for me to have supper with them.
Oh, right on. Final question. Yes. Dinner is important. The caller at 5992. Did you have a final question you wanted to get in for Dr. Cooper?
Hello, everyone. Hello, Dr. Cooper. I'm going to pass, Gus, because I didn't have a question. I just had a compliment. I'm going to say I feel Dr. is a very brilliant speaker, and I appreciate you sharing your time with us. Thank you very much.
Oh, right on. Appreciate that.
Gus, could you repeat the question?
She didn't have a question. She said she was going to pass. She said she just wanted to compliment you and thank you for coming on, that your work was brilliant, and she appreciated being able to hear you this evening, but she didn't have a question.
Okay. I thank the caller very much. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we'll try the caller on the vote line. Did you have a final question you wanted to get in for Dr. Cooper before she exits the program?
Yeah, I just was interested in what your opinion is about, because I know I read The Hanging of Angelique, and I was wondering, Canada was very involved in global colonialism, specifically in Africa, and benefiting off the labor and the resources of Africa. I was just wondering if you can expand a little bit about Canada's involvement in a global anti-blackness and how it's been involved in the colonization of African lands and African people directly on the continent. And how it relates to anti-blackness in Canada.
Well, the thing what we have to, thank you for your question, have to realize is that Canada was part of the colonial enterprise. It was first a colony of France. And these are imperial structures, right? And then secondly, it was a colony of Britain. And these imperial structures, France and Britain, had colonies all over the world. In an African continent. So what you had was movement of people. We'll talk about movement of people between Africa and our side of the Atlantic down to the Caribbean, whether it's the French Caribbean or the British Caribbean. Canada specifically as a sovereign state, well, even before it became a sovereign state, I talk about it being part of the imperial structure of France and then later on Great Britain. Great Britain defeated France in 1760 to quote-unquote take over Canada. But with the scramble for Africa let's say 1884, that's when the Berlin Conference happened. With that scramble for Africa, the country that we now call Canada and its people were part and parcel of the British imperial enterprise in Africa. We have a man by the name of William Steers. Of course, he's passed on. Steers. But he was a Canadian imperialist. He was right there with Stanley and Livingstone in Eastern and Central Africa. And like Thomas Thistlewood, he wrote a diary, which has been published. And this man is from Halifax, from a very respectable and well-known family in Nova Scotia. He writes about attacking villages in the Congo with the Maxim gun and raping black women in Central and East Africa. And when some of these people came back from their colonial exploits in Africa, they were welcomed on the shores of Halifax as heroes. So hundreds, if not thousands, of Canadians participated in the colonial enterprise in Africa. The Boer War, that was fought by the Boer, the Dutch, and the British in South Africa had thousands of soldiers from Canada, and in fact, many of them remained in South Africa where their families were established. Now, there's a Montreal author, his name is Engels, Engels, I can't remember the first name. But he has a book which you should look at. It's about 300 years of Canadian imperialism in Africa. And what a lot of people do not know is that Canada is a mining power. Mining as in mines, It is a mining power. We tend to think of the United States as hegemonic in these matters. But Canada is known around the world as a big mining power. Big, Barrick Gold, Peter Monk. They say Barrick Gold is a huge Canadian mining company. I was in Colombia last year, Colombia, South America. And when I told people, some people I was from Canada, they're like, they weren't very happy. They said, Canada just rewrote mining laws, they said. Canada rewrote the mining laws of Colombia. And in a lot of the disputed areas in the Pacific coast of Colombia, where you have the black and indigenous people live, and these people have been carted off their lands to make way for mines to be explored. That's Canada right there. Inside of the African continent itself, a lot of the big mining operations in Gabon, in southern countries of southern Africa, in Tanzania, in the Congo, we're looking at Canadian mining companies. So from day one, from the Berlin Conference 1994 to present time, Canada has had a huge presence on the African continent. First as kind of like a junior partner in the British Imperial Enterprise, and then as a fully-fledged, mature actor in its own right. So I would say, look at this book by Engels, E-N-G-E-L-S, 300 Years of Canadian Imperialism in Africa.
Right on.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
For sure. We will allow you to get back to the family and enjoy your evening dinner. It has been grand having you on the program. The book again, The Hanging of Angelique, The Untold Story of Canadian Slavery, and The Burning of Old Montreal. Dr. Afua Cooper, you've given us lots of additional sources to check out and research. We will be on our assignment. Hopefully we can have you back on the program to continue the dialogue. Just really enjoyed the conversation and wish you the best in continuing your outstanding research. We will look forward to speaking with you again soon, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you so much, and you have a good night.
Oh, for sure. You too.
And thanks to all the callers and listeners.
Thank you, Dr. Cooper. Please enjoy your meal. Enjoy your time with the family.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. I think we did miss a call over two, but tried to get in most of the folks that we could during the broadcast. I will again encourage, because we did have people that dialed in kind of late, you should get your hand up within the, really, as soon as possible. If I see that we have more people that dialed in with questions, I kind of adjust how we navigate the program, and I'll go ahead and get the callers later. People were not necessarily in a hurry to get their hand up on this one, so we can miss folks who dial in with questions if people are lollygagging to get their question in. We have guests on the program. Anywho, I was able to get both of the books, or at least two of the books that she mentioned. She mentioned quite a few, but two of the books that she mentioned, I was able to get my hands on while she was with us. One of them, the Douglas Hall book, In Miserable Slavery. That's the actual translation of Mr. Thistlewood's diary. Now, this is not Canadian history. This is in Jamaica, but still, it's, you know, interesting tidbits about white supremacy. And then Master, Tyranny, and Desire, which is also about Mr. Thistlewood in Jamaica. This is by Trevor Bernard, where he's kind of giving an analysis of the diary. It's not a direct translation per se. It's just more his thoughts on the diary. Both of these are pretty interesting. Mr. Bernard, just to give you kind of two quick portions from both of the books, obviously I hadn't had time to read them, but that was just kind of flicking through while she was with us to see if there was anything cool I could share. Mr. Bernard, Trevor Bernard, this is Mastery, Tyranny, and Desire. He has a section, it's Women and Resistance, where he writes, all of Thistlewood's slaves were to some extent psychologically damaged by their experiences as slaves. Their community, to the extent that it existed, was one marked by personal devastation and social trauma. Thistlewood's slaves were trapped in a dehumanizing life of exhausting labor, debilitating disease, and demeaning social relationships. They were constantly tired, frequently frightened, and subject to continual flux in their living and work arrangements. Thistlewood deliberately fostered these conditions. Always think it is apropos when the word deliberate is used when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. His carefully controlled but deliberate savagery, Captain Twines, his carefully controlled but deliberate savagery toward his slaves destabilized slave communities and allowed him to act as a vengeful facilitator who intervened powerfully, violently, and usually successfully in slaves' domestic and personal lives, bolstering his authority in a world where custom was attenuated, the law was of no avail, and a master's power was close to absolute. Thistlewood's female slaves faced especially difficult problems, particularly partly because of the nature of female slaves' experiences, but mostly because Thistlewood paid them special attention and made their lives particularly difficult. Slave women were workers, mothers, and sexual partners. See, I think this is a white person, Trevor Bernard, I'm not sure, but that term, sexual partners, implies some sort of equality or balanced just relationship, and that certainly was not the case. It should be, sexually abused, rape victims, something to connotate the incorrectness and the power imbalance that existed. Thistlewood interfered in all three areas and accentuated their trauma. Male slaves could avoid Thistlewood by working in the fields and keeping well away from their master. Women did not have that option. The big difference between slave women and slave men was that the women were both producers and reproducers. In addition, he was drawn to slave women for sexual gratification, as we have seen Thistlewood's relentless sexual opportunism. That's another one. Why isn't it just rape? Sexual barbarism, sexual terrorism meant that only very young and very old women were safe from him. Slave women consequently did not have the option of distance. They were intimate with Thistlewood whether they wanted to be or not, which sounds like rape, even though he's not using the term. I'm not sure, but I have to check to see if Trevor Bernard is in fact a white person. But that sounds like the way white people practice racism in writing about this sort of topic. This is from the actual diary translation, which is Douglas Hall, and that is a different book, In Miserable Slavery, different book entirely, where it's an actual translation of what Thistlewood himself wrote about his experiences in Jamaica. And again, I haven't had a chance to read either of these. I just kind of flipped through to see what they said. This book looks like quite a hoot. Now, they do give some explanation for how they were able to translate all this and a few notes here and there just so you can understand, but a lot of it is just direct. You know, this is what he purportedly wrote in his diary. So it says the next day, so this is 1756. The next day, the 24th, a woman slave, Phileas, caught breaking canes, was similarly treated but spared the gag. On the 31st, her punishment was repeated. The reason was not stated, but perhaps she had run away after the 24th. For on the 30th, two other runaways had been apprehended and punished. Friday, the 30th of July, 1756, Punch catched a Salt River and brought home, flogged him at Caco Well, and then washed and rubbed in salt pickle, lime juice, and bird pepper. Also whipped Hector for losing his hoe, made new Negro Joe piss in his eyes and mouth. On August 1st, another runaway, Hazad, who had absconded in early April, was caught, put him in the bilboes, both feet, gagged him, locked his hands together, rubbed him with molasses, and exposed him naked to the flies all day and to the mosquitoes all night without fire. And it just goes on to give you this sort of graphic detail. The sexual terrorism is in there as well, but I was not prepared for all of, you know, what was included. I do think this is important because, again, you always get these narratives that black people are lames and cowards and have not fought back. And what I have seen from what I've read from the diary portion, more than the sexual tyranny, is black people fighting back. Lots and lots of rumors that black people are uprising and are going to revolt and they're coming to kill white enslavers, and what must be done to put this down, and these sort of brutal acts of reprisal against black people who ran away or fought back or whatever they were doing to resist racism, white supremacy. But it seems like there is a lot of that in this book, major concern, and I would think it would have to be if you're in Jamaica with large numbers of black people. Anywho, before we nab any of the folks who are on the line, if you have any comments that you wanted to share from what you heard in the broadcast, I did think it was important. I had a couple questions that I did not get in just because I stopped to get some of our callers with regards to the hanging of Angelique. I, too, thought it was interesting. I think Dr. Cooper stated that she thought it was interesting in terms of when this fire happens in 1734 and Angelique is caught, convicted, tortured, and ultimately executed. Her white partner, Mr. Thibault, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, he was not caught in this sexual liaison tacky arrangement that they had. In my opinion, I think that that is no accident or coincidence. I think that that is typical of the system of white supremacy, and it would not surprise me at all. I was going to ask her if she thought this was reasonable. If he planned this, that I will just let this negress, and they use that term in the book repeatedly. It's throughout the book, negress. If he just said, I'm going to get her to take the blame for all of this. She'll be the one that gets punished. She'll be the one that gets caught. I am white, because she has in the book that when the fire breaks out, the white people are immediately like, Angelique did it. They have people, they have the town crier running around and saying, this negress did it. She did it. She did it. So all the attention is focused on her. And he is just chilling, like he's eating a meal, and people are like, why aren't you helping put out the fire? And he says, oh, I'm tired. I'm just tired. I had a long, long day, and, you know, I just don't have the energy to go do it. I mean, the whole city, not the whole city, but, I mean, it burned down like a sizable portion of Montreal. I mean, reports say that half of the city burned up, but this is not a small deal. And he's like, oh, I'm tired. I don't have the energy to do it. And then he absconds. He gets away. To me, this sounds very, very much like the planning of a white person anytime that they would say, yeah, I'm just going to let the black person catch the blame, and I am out of here. Peace out. I already knew. I already got my route planned. This is what my intentions were from the very beginning. That's exactly what it sounds like to me. I was curious to see what you had to say about that, but that was just one of the last questions that I had to get with. From the book, but lots of great information in the book. Hoot having her on the program. With that, if any of the folks who dialed in had questions, comments, anything stood out from what you heard in the broadcast, you should be with us. Your line should be open if you had anything you wanted to share.
Hey, you know, one thing that stood out, she said that the Canadian passed some labor laws, and it turns out that the people who benefit from it most are not the black people, it's the white women. I said, man, it sounds just like affirmative action. Very interesting.
I noted that too. I also learned that the plantation operates worldwide. Somehow black people go out and die and have dogs sit on them and children beaten and killed and everything, and the winner is white women. Anything else, folks, commentary, folks wanted to make sure they got in?
May I be heard?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I think the other callers, one of the callers was asking Cooper a question about, like, whether a majority of black Canadians are directly from diaspora, specifically in the Caribbean. I think that a lot of people forget that the Caribbean was also, like, also had slavery. So a lot of people from the Caribbean identify as being African because they are originally from Africa. And also to add in that whether you are directly from Africa or like a new immigrant, a lot of us can't go back home because of global white supremacy. So our lands are occupied by white supremacists that are using our land to exploit it for resources. So we're displaced people ultimately. And because of the system of white supremacy, we can't go home. So I think that people kind of forget how the global system of white supremacy acts. It's something that, just like we're being brutalized in North America, our people are being brutalized back home. So I think it's really important to understand how the system works globally and not just domestically.
Oh, I had asked the question. It wasn't because of that. I used that correlation to just, I wanted to know how many Canadians are, hey, if you're in America and you've been here for a certain amount of time,
You were called the Negro at one time. You was called the colored at one time. You was called the nigger at one time. And those are the only names that you've ever had. So I wanted to know how many Canadians are Canadians, not Jamaican Canadians, not Haitian Canadians, or second, third generation Haitian Canadian. I just simply want to know how many of those people are American Canadians, black Canadians, not from somewhere else. That's why I asked that question.
Thomas, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
It's just for clarification. What I thought from the moment you asked that question, and I didn't think she was equipped to really know that, possibly because she was an immigrant from Jamaica, is were you alluding to the original black people who were here from 60,000 BC that the white people actually encountered when they originally came here to begin with, and in North America specifically, are the foundation of the entire African-American community here, minus very few people that were brought here from Africa, in other words. Is that the group that you're speaking of, people who would be direct descendants of those indigenous Americans who were the first people that were here?
No, I wasn't talking about that aspect of it at all. I just want to know how many of these Canadians are Canadian niggas. That's all I wanted to know. That's
okay. No problem. Wow, interesting. I was going to say, Gus, I thought it was really good that you brought up the aspect of the white man getting away. I thought of the same thing. It just reminds me of all the times that we talk about the statistics on drugs and how, you know, white people cars are full of drugs and they just drive right by the police because they're white. And, you know, the white cops or even black cops, but cops are just pulling over anything that's black in a vehicle while a white person who has all the drugs in their vehicle is driving right by. Or Shane from Walking Dead when he shot the other guy so he could escape. I thought of that as well when you talked about the guy getting away and him maybe putting everything, like you said, all the focus and attention on Angelique so that he could make his escape. I thought on a similar vein, so I really am glad you brought that up. I thought her comments were really, really great. I thought she had a really great understanding of the system of white supremacy. I appreciate what she had to say. I liked the way she answered the question I asked in regards to the differences of how she experienced racism in Jamaica versus in the Caribbean, because I heard similar stories from my parents as well. Even though my father told me, he was told in Trinidad that black people had made no contribution to human history. And it was when he actually came to New York, he had met Kwame Ture, and that's where everything started as far as his understanding of who he was as a black man. So I just found her insight very, very profound. And thanks for the program. It was brilliant. I appreciate it. I can't wait to read the book as well, because I think just from what I heard and how she answered the question in regards to Mrs. Angelique's codification in using this white male. Sadly, she did, you know, have a tragic arrangement, but at least she was thinking ahead as far as trying to escape. Sadly, I think he probably pulled a slick one on her and set her up to take the fall so he could get away. So I wish her soul rest. Thank you.
Ashe. Ashe. I will say, if you read the book, you will see that a lot of this is interpretation. Like, Angelique did not write, you know, a manifesto where she laid out her view on all of this and what her master plan was. So a lot of this is people just looking at the record and the court transcript from what happened and other historical documents and just trying to come to a conclusion about what they think happened. So it might not be that this was some sort of love affair. This could have been a rape. I mean, who knows what this, you know, arrangement could have been, because you don't have that. I think if you read the book, and any of the people that are on the phone, on the broadcast now, who called in, if you read the book, if you can set me straight if I misinterpreted that, but I think that is accurate if you read it. A lot of this is kind of up to your own interpretation. I think Dr. Cooper does that in the book and saying, you know, was this a love affair? Or was, you know, was this something else? Was this a partnership just to see if we can both get out of here? That type of thing. So a lot of this is up to interpretation in terms of what this was. But I will stick by what I said in terms of, I think this white man was practicing white supremacy and just said, this nigger is going to catch it and I am going to be gone before they even know what happened.
That sounds like the white people I know, which is all white people. So I think you're accurate. I agree.
Anybody that we missed who dialed in, if you didn't get a chance to ask a question, if you would like to share, if you did have a question or anything that stood out from the broadcast, 3844, you should be with us as well. Anybody else have any questions or observations? Oh, everybody satisfied? 3844 should be with us as well, but if you didn't have a question or anything you want to share.
Oh, I do.
Yes, sir.
Yes, you mentioned the Sexual Abuse of Black Males by Thomas Foster, and you also mentioned another one. What was the other one?
You
books, two of them.
Let's see. I will have to go pull my list up here. I know I mentioned the American Slave Code. Now, that does not have any information on black males being sexually exploited during slavery. That's all it does have, tons and tons and tons and tons. That's like the main theme of the book in terms of black females being forcibly raped, that being like one of the fundamental requirements of the slave system here in the United States. But that doesn't have anything about black males being sexually abused. Let's see. Books that do have information on that would be... Okay. Okay, books that do have information on that, Recreating Africa by James Stewart, and that deals with the Caribbean. And has like really elaborate graphic scenes where black males specifically being raped as a form of punishment and sadomasochistic enjoyment, whites taking advantage sexually of black males. Dr. Mwalimu Baruti, Homosexuality and the Feminization of African Males, where he goes back to track a lot of this behavior during the plantation phase of slavery. He's been on the program 5 times. We talked about that book the very first time, February 2010. Colonialism and Homosexuality, a White Male.
Okay, hold on. Okay, hold on a second.
Mm-hmm.
Colonialism and Homosexuality.
Mm-hmm. I think that's Robert Aldrich. I might have the name incorrect, but I think that's it. Robert Aldrich, Colonialism and Homosexuality. That deals globally with how the domination of the continent opened up all these opportunities for whites to explore their sexual deviance because they had all these rules and regulations allegedly prohibiting this behavior back in Europe and wherever else they were coming from. They didn't have all of that. They could go to the continent and do whatever they wanted with Negroes. They have graphic imaging and pictures from this time period, and just, oh, this is, if you can imagine Jerry Sandusky, like, oh, I can do whatever I want to. This is grand. That's Colonialism and Homosexuality. Texas Tough, which is beyond the, like, I can't even really say that. It is after, quote-unquote, slavery ends, allegedly, but just the different phase of slavery, white supremacy. Texas Tough, Robert Perkinson, he was on the program in June of 2010, where he talks specifically about white jailers in Texas. They would sodomize and anally rape black inmates and brag about it. He has one scene where a white warden officer in the prison, he anally rapes a black male in front of the other inmates. And this is like 1900s. This is not ancient history. This is 20th century. Some of our parents or grandparents were alive when this happened. He rapes him in front of the other slaves. He pulls his penis out of his rectum, turns to the black people and asks them if they want to, quote unquote, smell the bat. I will never forget that as long as I live. We asked him, the author, Robert Perkinson, about that directly when he was on the program. Dr. Tommy Curry has written about this specifically. He was the one that referenced Thomas Foster's work, The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery, and I think he has other sources as well. That's just like a snippet. There are other sources as well that document this pattern of behavior of black males, specifically black children and older black males being sexually terrorized during formal plantation slavery, and this just continuing all the way up through to 2016.
What was the title of the Robert Perkins work?
Texas Tough.
Texas Tough. T-O-U-G-H.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, but that's part of it. It's hard to find because what made me interested is that I found an article on the internet, but it's very hard to find it about the sexual molestation of males. That's very hard to find information on that.
I agree, and I have pointed that out consistently that you, and it's not like it's they, you know, make an effort to have that central when talking about slavery, the rape of black females, but I mean, you will, that was in The Half Has Never Been Told. It is the central theme of the American Slave Coast, but the same thing happened in the black males. That is a lot more obscure, and both of those are like central features of racism, white supremacy, whichever era, the plantation phase or the slavery white supremacy phase right now, 2016, those are central aspects of how all of this functions.
All right. Thanks a lot for the information.
Mm-hmm.
Gus, I just wanted to say you were correct about Robert Aldrich being the author of that book. I have it home. And also, I wanted to throw out Delectable Negro.
Oh, yep, that's right. That's right. There are more sources. There, a listener was doing a project on all of this. There are more sources. That's just what I have off the kind of top of my head and just being able to look at one note quickly. But there are other sources that have that information. You just kind of have to. It's a good thing to keep a folder on that as you find them, in my opinion, because that is valuable information to have. And that's another one where whites all of a sudden saying they're totally ignorant. I didn't know anything about. I'm not talking about Dr. Cooper. I'm just saying that white people somehow seem very ignorant, like they're stunned about that. They didn't know anything about that. And I find that hard to believe as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, Gus, for having her on. It was really good. And I have to say with her is I think she's one of the best long answer responses that I've ever heard because I actually have a 10-year-old black male child with me. I'm trying to make him understand how Canada really is. And one of the things she said is that it helps him really learn better hearing her actually draw out her answers like that. So that's something I wanted to add. It was one of the best. Rarely I usually don't like answers like that, but hers were really well connected, I noticed, and how she responded to everybody was really good. That's something I noticed. I'll mute my line.
I thought that too. I thought she was not just talking to be talking or evading the question. I thought she was just providing more detail, being very comprehensive. She dropped a lot of books and other material for people to go and do research if they were so inclined. As she responded, I thought she just gave a lot of very detailed, very accurate, substantive responses. It was great. It was. I was a little bummed because I did want to ask her like what she thought about all of these slave films coming out, The Book of Negroes, which is about racism, well, kind of about racism in Canada and the Free State of Jones and Django and the Roots remake and blah, blah, blah. You just keep going. The Birth of a Nation, the Nate Parker project that's coming out later this year. What she thought about all of those, if that was something that was constructive in getting this information out or if that was just more terror porn for whites. I did want to ask her that, but you know. Hey, can't do everything. Hopefully we can get her back on the program and she can give us her thoughts. The caller at 4683, did you have a comment, question you wanted to get in?
Yeah, hello. Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hey, man, how everybody doing? Hey, so, listen, I just called in, right? So what it was, a white lady, she horned up?
I'm sorry?
She what happened to her, though? I just got in. I've been working, man. I've been listening to the old program. I don't know what happened. I guess I thought that was gonna be a black person was on tonight, but I guess it was a white lady.
No, we did have anyway, we had a black guest. Huh? We did have a black guest. Dr. Afua Cooper was the guest for the program, and she was here for about 2.5 hours. She took questions from listeners and the whole thing, but she had to have dinner with her family. There's a 3-hour time difference, so it is for her, it's like 11 p.m. now. So if she's going to eat dinner, like that is a very late meal. So she just had, that was all the time that she could give us this evening. But she was, I thought she gave a lot of great information. It was great talking about her book, and it'll be in the archives if you want to check it out.
Oh, okay. Well, listen, man, I just wanted to say, and I ain't going to even be long, man, just a couple of sentences, because I've been working, and I haven't been able to call in live. But I've been listening. I caught the thing Saturday after, because, you know, I'm from Houston, man, and I heard, you know, when the thing went down with Dallas, and I heard, and I mean, I don't know if that was us or not, but I'm glad that they giving it to us, you know, and we should look at it like that. Well, like, well, you know, that's the mind. By the book, because I have been following the book. And it kind of seemed like, man, that lady, Miss Harriet Washington, she an excellent researcher. You know, she researched that book real good and gave us the history on that book. But then with the epilogue or whatever, that last little piece, the ending of it, it kind of seemed like she trying to put us back in there. You know, I might be wrong, because now it was a lot of words that I ain't really understand. But just going with the flow of it and how the man was reading it, it kind of seemed like she was saying, well, okay, well, black people, we need to go back and start doing these researches after all these years of stuff she done wrote, you know. And I might be wrong, and I'm sorry if I'm off topic. And because, you know, I follow, you know, I listen to it every day, man. And, you know, and I just wanted to say, man, you know, and, you know, but I'm glad, man, I'm glad everything going. And I was telling my mama back in 2008, I was in prison, man, in Florida. And I was like, man, you know, man, I think, you know, because I say when I start reading and start thinking and kind of looking at things different, I say, man, you know, things, son, just, you know, this can't be the best. And let me say this, if you don't mind, if I can get 5 minutes, man, what I want to say is.
It can't be five minutes.
Well, you can cut me off whenever you get ready, man. You can just mute me out. But it ain't going to take long, but I want to say this, though, because I know a lot of people, last week when you had Dr. Cambone on there, and a lot of people, you know, say that they like him as far as he one of their favorites. Now, I remember his C-SPAN, and he was saying what's got to go down, okay? And the same thing, Elijah Muhammad said the same thing, and so did, and so my thing is, we steady saying, not, but I hear a lot of people say, even white people, that white lady say, well, why should we change? And we say, and we know, you know, we ain't no change in these people. This who they are. You know, however it happened like that, it's sorry that it's like that, but ain't nothing going to change with how these people look at us and how they going to treat us, right? And Dr. Cambone been saying for the longest, man, that it just like Elijah Muhammad, ain't going to be no peace, you know. So I think that it's going to come to that point, because really, when you really look at it, man, black people, we don't got nothing to live for, you know. I mean, we don't got nothing to lose. You see what I'm saying? If we ain't going to fight and we ain't going to do, what, it's going to be a continuation of what we seeing. It's just going to change up. Because, see, my mama say, well, you always talking about slavery. It's different. This a new day and era and all that. And that's a lot of black people. And if you've been looking at the news since all this been going on, black people, you can see how the black people that get on the TV, don't nobody put no questions to these people. You know, ask these people, man, why... Hold on. Why do you keep talking about these police officers? You know what I'm saying? Excuse me, but man, I don't care nothing about no police. Anybody who you know, I don't care nothing about white people. I don't care nothing about no Mexican or about no Native Indian. You know, I don't care about none of that. You know. And life is, and life, and I heard another lady from that Saturday program, and she say that is she very depressed, you know. And that's how I feel, man. You know, because a lot of us in my generation, I'm 36, right? We don't get to have the pleasures of life. We don't know what it is to be loved. you know, and how to love. Because black males, we say, man, fuck these hoes. Excuse my language. But that's a black thing.
Keep it G-rated.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, y'all. But y'all know what I'm saying, though, right? And that, and that's the way of our mind. And it's like, man, it's like we miss out on a lot of stuff, man. And it's like we really, and I know a lot of people like Mr. Fuller. I like Mr. Fuller. I like Ms. Wilson, too. They, you know, but they also said two things. They still learning. We all trying to figure out, but the answer there is scary too. And Fuller said, "Man, it's scary." I think he told what's the lady wrote that book Pam. He said, "Yeah, it's scary." You know what I mean? When she asked him about do he talk to white people that won't really seem sincere, and he was like, "Yeah, it's you know, it's a scary thing, and it is." But you gotta look at it, man. What do we got to lose? When we talk to each other, we
I
say
will hop in right
these
there,
people
sir.
Ain't gonna. Yes, sir.
Appreciate it.
Well, go ahead, cut me off, Gus. I'm listening, man.
Right on. And you can feel free to dial in on the compensatory call in on Saturday. That is what the program is designed for. People can dial in and share their views, thoughts, observations. On things that are happening. I'm sure the Dallas thing will come up again this weekend. So if you have time to dial in this Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I guess you are Central if you said Houston. So Central, that would be Saturday at 8 p.m. Central time for the compensatory call-in if you want to get your views. Since the Dallas thing was mentioned, one thing that I will say, and this is just a suggestion, I'm sure we all can use our brain computer, as Dr. Welsing would say, to come to our own conclusions, thoughts, analyses about things that are happening, what's the best way to proceed. My suggestion would be I would not be posting anything on Facebook because I've seen people have photographs of the alleged shooter in Dallas, Micah Xavier Johnson. I would not have any photographs of him on my social media or even be making any public comments, making it seem like I'm celebrating or encouraging what this person did. I could easily see in this environment racist taking that as you are encouraging, supporting terrorist activity or any activity that they deem to be criminal and finding some way of making that a charge, particularly since it was related to enforcement officials. I would be very cautious about that. As I said, I would not encourage having the photographs up on social media and Facebook and that sort of thing, because I could easily see that bringing a lot of unwanted attention. It's been my experience that victims of racism, you are alive. I think at least most individuals, they do attach some value to being alive, even in a system of racism, white supremacy. That tends to be the case just for humans, period. So I would say unless you are ready to cease existence like right now, you do have something to lose. And I think just by evidence, you're still here. People have not done anything to cease their existence. There are means of doing that. Dr. Kanban has written about that as well. So you do have something to lose, in addition to probably some other things as well. I would be cautious about that. I also, since I know people are talking about the Dallas situation, my suggestion would be to be cautious about analyzing that, period. We are dealing with master deceivers. It can be very difficult to even gauge what is true and what is not true about that incident, if Mr. Johnson was involved at all, or what happened. Just on that basis alone, you're not going to have a trial here where there's some sort of conclusion about all of that. I would be very cautious about any of that in terms of celebrating or I'm happy about it or whatever the case, whatever you think about it. I would be a bit more strategic about how I articulate my views, particularly if it's going to be publicly. I'm also just noting something that is an inconsistency just based on the last three times that this sort of thing has happened where a black person was accused with no trial of killing enforcement officials, Christopher Dorner, Ismael Brinsley, and now Micah Johnson. With the last three times that this took place, with Christopher Dorner, the first two victims that he was accused of killing, they were both non-white. It was an Asian female and a black male that he was accused of killing. No trial, no conviction. This is just what was reported. I said then immediately that this is nothing to celebrate. I wouldn't care how upset you are about racism if the result is kill, harm non-white people. That makes no logical sense to me. That's what we are supposed to be getting rid of, non-white people harmed. We had lots of people who dialed into this here program to say, Gus, you're talking crazy. I think what Christopher Dorner did is great. You got to start somewhere. And these non-white people, they had affiliations with enforcement officers. And, hey, you got to do something about this. And if a few eggs are broken, and I'm using that metaphor because that's what was said when this all this went down back in 2013. You got to break a few eggs in order to get this done. And I don't have a problem with it. Right on, Christopher Dorner. And the same thing. People had his photo up on their social media pages and all that. Right on, yay for Christopher Dorner. And I said, this is nothing to celebrate. We asked Dr. Welsing about it. She said the same thing. Mr. Fuller said the same thing with Ishmael Brinsley. The first person, before he got to those enforcement officers in New York, he shot his black female partner. I didn't think that was anything to celebrate either, and I wrote about that incident. I wrote about the Christopher Dorner incident as well, and I asked the question because I had a problem with people saying that Ishmael Brinsley was crazy, just dismissing him as some rabid, psychotic Negro, and I said this could have just been a logical response to white supremacy. I'm going after enforcement officers because they keep killing us, and people said, hey, wait a minute, he killed a black female, or he shot a black female, and that's not, you know, anything to celebrate, blah, 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 which I never said it was, but I had no problem acknowledging that. In this situation, at least the photos I have seen, there was a black female who was shot. That's not supposed to happen. If you resort to counterviolence, if that's what you think this was, if you resort to counterviolence, something must be done, and I'm going to do it. No non-white people should be harmed. In my view, nothing should ever be celebrated where non-white people are harmed. If you're going to go and you say that the response to dealing with racism is that there should be counterviolence, fine, but I'm going to plan this out and make sure that when I carry out my acts, there should be no non-white people harmed. Not a scratch, not a paper cut, not nothing. There was a black female who was one of the people that was allegedly harmed when this happened. That alone for me would be enough to say, this is nothing that I'm going to jump up and down and celebrate. I think Mr. Fuller would add that we should not be celebrating death anyway. That's what racists do, jumping up and down and celebrating death. We want to leave that culture alone. Killing is something that should not be a cause for rejoicing and clapping. If you have to do it, fine. You do what you have to do, but it's not anything that, yes, right on. Whoopee! Norm Stamper wrote about that. He should be coming back on the program. He wrote about that. That's what whites do. He said that's exactly the way they function. He said as an enforcement official, that's what they did. You killed somebody, right on, like you scored a touchdown. You go in and are giving high fives and all that. I think that's one thing we do not want to emulate of racist culture. I could be in error, and even if I'm not, folks certainly are free to come to their own conclusion. But since that did come up, that was something that I was going to make sure I said on the program in terms of caution, because there was a non-white person who was reportedly harmed, a black female, no less, a black mother, no less, who was reportedly shot in all of this. That alone for me would disqualify this as anything that I would celebrate or rejoice about. And two, even if you don't care about that, I would just be cautious because it is difficult to know the truth about celebrating, rejoicing about this event, period. I could see racists making that a problem for you if they choose to do so. And I think there's already evidence that that has happened to some people. I will stop there. We did our 3 hours plus for the program. If folks, I am sure, will have commentary about the incident in Dallas and other things that have happened over the past week or so since all of that went down. Compensatory call-in. We'll be here Saturday. We might even be back before then. I know Pam wanted to talk about these events, so she should be on the program. If not tomorrow, it'll be next Wednesday. And Norm Stamper should be back with us either sometime within the next 5 days. He's the former police officer, former chief of the Seattle Police Department. He wrote the book Breaking Rank. He made the commentary about how enforcement officials, the darker the black male, the bigger the black male, the more afraid they are, and they are going to be ready for violence. That's how you end up with Philando Castile and these other incidents that people have been talking about. That was his major statement. He was quoted here in the Seattle Times, where they were asking him his thoughts on all the events that took place in Dallas. But he should be back with us in a matter of days. Anywho, if you have questions, comments, thoughts you would like to share, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Feel free to share if you have comments, observations, thoughts you'd like to share on the program you heard from today, and or anything moving forward. If you have guest suggestions, feel free. One of our listeners in Canada suggested Dr. Afua Cooper for the program today. Great information. If you have suggestions, again, the email UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. I would look for those books that I mentioned, Mastery, Tyranny, and Desire. You can check that one. You can also check for In Miserable Slavery. Those are the two of the books out of many that Dr. Cooper mentioned. I got both of those since we were on air. Fascinating. I haven't even been able to read them all, but what I've seen thus far, fascinating. That will do it. Sobriety, I would encourage. That is one thing that I saw immediately looking at these texts, that it seemed like there was a lot of passing out of rum to black people in order to keep them controlled, docile, dominated, so that they would not be conspiring about how to go about absconding from the plantation and perhaps resorting to counterviolence in dealing with these white enslavers. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. You never know when you will be stopped by a race soldier and just a regular white civilian, no badge needed. You want to be able to make phenomenal decisions at all times to keep yourself safe, you and anyone that you might be responsible for. That goes if you are in a vehicle, driver, passenger, even if you're a pedestrian. Sobriety is, being under the influence is going to make any of those encounters 1,000 times worse. Buckle up if you're in a vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That being said, thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope you got some constructive info for your Tuesday evening, and we'll be back soon. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.